This is a production of Cornell University.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started here. So how this is going to go, I'm going to go question by question through the document. It's in sequential order. I will be sharing my screen, and for the comment that I think applies to the question the best, I'll just click on it so everyone can see it. Take your time to read it. And if you do have questions, just ask the question to the commenter. And we can just go from there. After the time has elapsed on each question, I'm not going to ask for a form, like for a motion. I'm just going to go into the vote because I think that formalized motion just kind of gunks up time. And so I'll be doing that throughout. If the person who had the original comment or feels as though the question no longer applies to their comment, just, you know, shout it out at the beginning as we move into the question, say, you know, our comment, the comment doesn't apply anymore. We think that changes that have been made accurately resolve any issues we've had. And we will go further. We will go on to the sections. I'll be noting the votes. I've tried to make most of the questions as shoulds, you know, yes, no's, to make it very clear. But if you do have a question on how I work, if you do have a confusion on how I worded a question, or you don't know how the vote of this question will go, just like ask me and then we'll go through it. So yeah, any questions before we get started on this? Good to go. Okay. Here we go. There we go. So, the first question we have applies to section 251. It basically is asking, should it maintain as written, or should it be condensed to just saying it's up to the vice president of student campus life to determine the correct procedures for this process. So at an ad hoc basis, the VPSEL has the ability to change the process or as it is, or should it be as written? So we'll start here. If you want to raise your hand on the thing, raise your hand. Sometimes I might miss it, or just go straight into the whole entire thing. Here, let me go back to where it is. 251. There we go. So that's the comment. And the 3 minutes for this question is now on the clock. Whoever wants to start, just go for it.
Joe, you know, it's so weird to look at this stuff. I don't know about everybody else, but it's like I have my copy and then I've got this one and it's tiny on my screen. And I don't know if everybody else is having that same problem, you know, because I'm trying to look at two different things. And this thing of you got 3 minutes on the clock, I'm just finding very weird. I just would find it very, very useful. I mean, I think it's fine as it is, but perhaps I would find it useful if somebody who feels strongly about changing it would just say something very quickly about that.
Yeah. Barb, please.
I think the main point from our office's perspective is we believe strongly that it should be the vice president who should review decisions about interim sanctions, interim measures, including temporary suspensions, for, among other reasons, because of the need for a prompt review. And that can be true for interim measures as well as temporary suspensions. We think that convening a panel is time consuming. So this comment applies to this one and 2.5.3. We think it would be best to leave this decision to the vice president.
Okay. Knowing that background information, I'll combine the first two questions of 251 and 253. Should it be as written, which is an appeal panel, or should it just be up to the VPSEL by themselves? So it's going to be we're going to combine the times on that question, now knowing the background.
And I would just throw in that I think the VPSEL makes the most sense because oftentimes these interim measures are for safety. And if there's an issue of safety that a student is in an unsafe situation or another student has violated a student, we need to quickly act. The fastest we can do that and the safest way to protect our students is to have the authority lie with the VPSCL, who obviously has the whole campus's student safety in their mind.
Great. Gabrielle.
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify. So just for, because you said we're going to combine the 251 and 253. So 251 would allow the VPSCL to review any interim measures excluding a temporary suspension. And so the rationale behind, you know, taking the temporary suspension out of that, while it does impact campus safety, the time limits in the code are meant to kind of alleviate some of those concerns, but the need to have someone else review it is just to recognize the importance of an independent body to review something when you're creating a break from the university without a finding of responsibility.
I was just talking about combining the discussion of the two questions, not necessarily combining the passages.
Okay, yeah, no, I just wanted to clarify, because if you're going to have people vote like yes or no, like it's not exactly the same vote, but that was all I meant.
Yeah. Yeah. Risa?
Yeah, yeah, I think that's, I wanted to underline the part that Gabrielle was talking about in terms of the review here that moves away from the vice, whatever it is, always forget the title, but that's a review of a temporary suspension. It's regarding lifting the temporary suspension by an appeal panel, which is, you know, it doesn't violate any kind of safety concern, but it is a severe enough temporary measure that that a review of that should be by an independent appeals panel.
Anyone else on these two ideas or these two questions? If there isn't anything more, I'm going to ask for the vote on these two questions. So the first one concerning section 251, should it maintain as written or move to the VPSCL in an ad hoc nature on these appeals, excluding the imposition of temporary suspensions? So yes, if you want to keep it as written, or no, if you want to move it to an ad hoc basis of which the VPSCL determines it. This is for 251 only. You could use your checkboxes or the comments for myself. Uche, I'm waiting on you. There we go. So the vote is 6-2. So this section will be maintained as written. The next question I have is section 253. Should it be the appeal panel, which is as written, or the VPSCL on an ad hoc basis? I'm clearing all votes again. So please take a yes would be an appeal panel, thus as written, and a no would be VPSCL on an ad hoc basis.
Joe, I'm sorry, can I ask a quick question? So did we just vote that in order to put into place interim measures, we're following what's written in the document?
Yes. Yeah, Gabrielle.
That's not to put in place interim measures, that because above it gives the JA power to put those measures in place. This is just for an appeal of any interim measure or like a modification besides temporary suspension.
Right. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that. Thanks. So again, we're on the vote for section 253, leaving it as written, or VPSCL on an ad hoc basis. Yes is leaving it as written. Okay, by a vote of 7-1, it's going to be maintained as written. The next question I have for discussion is on in section 3 on how mental health is presented in the situation. So here are the comments that are there, and I see Barb's hand up to start off.
Yeah, having given this some more thought, we do think it's better that mental health information be deferred until the sanctions phase, but we don't feel strongly about this, strongly enough about this, given that it's the respondent's choice. So unless there are other people who want to advocate for the position we had raised in the comments, we're happy to let it go. Or prepared to let it go, I'll say that.
Jen, go for it.
I don't feel strongly. I just think it's odd to have it mental health written into the code as part of this section. I don't know. For everything I said the other day, I feel the same way still today.
Would you want a formal vote of the committee or just an informal note?
I feel if we had a formal vote, I'd continue to be the only no, so you could just move on.
Okay. Gabrielle?
I don't know if this alleviates any of those concerns about just having it as mental health, so I don't know if changing it to a more general term would be helpful. So if it's mental or physical health, or I don't know, I can't really think of anything right now on the spot, but maybe making it more general. I don't know, Jen, if that helps at all, because I mean looking at it is kind of specific, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, like I said the other day, I understand that students are stressed and there are mental health concerns, and that there are declared, the student's disability office manages students with mental health concerns, but also with other things. And there's other things that play into people's whole person. And I don't know if an investigator should consider just a student's mental health when making a determination of how to resolve the formal complaint. There could be other things, if we're considering other pieces of people other than the actual information, to single out mental health to me seems, and then how do we determine that? How do we determine if the student's mental health is an issue or not? Only if they disclose it, I guess, but then does that then benefit the students that are comfortable disclosing their mental health conditions over the ones that aren't? I don't know. It's everything I said the other day. I just feel it's a little bit weird to me.
Mm-hmm. Risa?
Yeah, thanks. I was kind of reading and listening at the same time to what Gabrielle was saying, but I think what makes sense from what I understood from what Gabrielle was saying was perhaps, rather than being so specific about mental health, it could be something along the lines of a respondent may present information about their about health issues, health or other personal issues. I don't have the exact wording, but something that doesn't say mental health is the only thing that matters. I mean, my sense is that when people are using discretion, which is what the JA's office does, they use discretion at various points, that having information that could make a difference in terms of where does this case belong the most is equitable, it's humane, it's just a really, that would be one of the things that I would like about being in that position of JA, would be to be able to do that, so that maybe broadening it out a little bit from mental health, maybe we could work on that in a break or something, would be helpful.
Yeah, Bryce suggested potentially circumstances, Kat suggested potentially well-being in the chat, but I see Barb and Gabrielle have thoughts on this, so Barb.
Yeah, I do think that is what the JA's office does when we have these meetings. and we consider the circumstances. And so I agree with the concerns that Jen has stated. And I think that this is in some ways trying to specify one single place to make sure that we consider things that the JA's office considers, you know, if that we do exercise discretion, as Risa said.
Gabrielle.
Yeah, I think so. If I could just give an example, which this is not in the code context, it's in academic integrity, but our office worked with a student who like had testing accommodations and among other things. And during an AI proceeding, the professor just did not even like consider it. There was like evidence of it just, so the reason why I think this, some version of this should be in here is just a recognition on the student's side to know I can say this in the meeting, like whether or not the case handler says something like that that would prompt it or whether the JA will consider it. I do just think it's important to codify it here to say, look, you can say this in the meeting. And it's okay.
My suggestion is instead of mental health, we say personal circumstances and well-being. I think that's broad and general enough that it does allow a possibility to be broadened. So that is my recommendation for the language change, if, you know, people are okay with that. If I'll say personals, and I'll just ask for a vote on that language if people are comfortable with a vote. I can't see everything that I'm typing. So the change is removing mental health and changing it to personal circumstances and well-being. That's okay. So, yep, just make the checks and the boxes and everything like that, and I'll count that. Yes is you like the change, no is you don't like the change. Seven to zero, that change has been made. Thank you. We'll be moving on to section 4.2. This question deals with to prior conduct from any other previous institutions, or just limit the conduct to conduct at Cornell. And so that is the kind of change. It's also noted in further sections, this also in section 5.6. So that's the question. And here is the comment that it applies to. So whoever has thoughts.
One quick, this is Barb, sorry, one quick for this might just be to distinguish that we always consider their prior disciplinary record at Cornell. We consider disciplinary record from elsewhere and any criminal convictions if known. I think we don't want to create a situation where the JA's office has to go look for those things or pay money for background checks or things like that.
Risa.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, sorry about the dog barking. I actually made the change based on that recommendation. So, you know, I just want to say in terms of this, oftentimes we're opposing each other on these things, but in the same spirit of where we just were, also, you know, that's fine to me.
Okay. Gabrielle.
Yeah, I just wanted to say the same thing that I agree.
Okay. So. Perfect. So if that change has been made, we'll note that and we'll move on. The next one was also in 4.2. Should suspension be up to 3 years, up to 5 years, or limitless? This is the comment that applies to it. If people have initial questions as to what this means, you know, go for it. And if not, just whoever wants to go. Gabrielle.
So from what I'm gathering from the comment, it sounds like the JA's office also does not necessarily support the indefinite suspension with a right to petition. I would also agree with that. I think that that process is just very confusing and very stressful for students. Like the thought of, even though, you know, a suspension is a really big deal in and of itself, but like, do I even have a chance to apply again? And I recently worked with someone on that application, and it is truly very just traumatic. If the concern is about creating a break from the university with enough time to allow those who were impacted to graduate, I would suggest making it 4 years instead of five. But yeah.
I would just say some programs are five. So architecture is a five-year program. So if we're looking at the university as a whole, there are some undergrad programs that are longer than four. But I don't know if we're considering all of that or just going in general because we are the smallest. And I don't know if there's any other undergrad programs, or this covers grad students too. And sometimes doctoral students are around for a long time too. So I was in favor of the five just to cover a bigger group.
I think also it's
Barb.
It's a not to exceed 3 years. Not to exceed 5 years is the proposal. I think five is better for two reasons. One is somebody who's impacted often has had to take time away from time out of their studies as well. So it may be that they need more than 4 years. But also it's a not to exceed. And so it gives discretion for somebody to find out what is the status of the person who's been affected. And, you know, if they only need 4 years, it only needs to be four. If it needs five, it can be five. I think it just gives more flexibility to cover the greater number of cases.
Yeah, Risa.
I actually have a question in terms of practice on this. I mean, because that's a long time, you know, 3 years is a long time. It's quite severe, 4 or 5, you know, even longer. So what has been the practice in terms of the record of suspensions, and what tends to, I mean, is there some pattern that you can describe about what has been the case?
I would normally be the one to answer that question, but I can't speak to what's happened in the office most currently. I invite Christina, if she has information about that, to chime in. Gabrielle may also know. My sense is Cornell doesn't suspend or expel very many people, just like many institutions don't. But
so in the past 5 years that I've been here, Risa, I believe there's only been 2 or 3 substantial suspensions for multiple years, and they involved a physical assault with a substantial, perhaps permanent injury, as well as egregious hazing violation. The only expulsion I'm familiar with is of an organization.
And how long were the suspensions for, do you recall?
3 years each.
3 years. And was that the max at that time?
No, I believe it's up to 5 in the current code.
Okay.
Anything else to add? Yeah, Bryce.
So just a quick question then, Christina. So you obviously can't say much about what happened there, but, you know, was choosing 3 rather than 5, was it owing to the severity, or is it generally, I mean, those sound like cases where you really want, where the severity is pretty much infinity. For our purposes, I mean, they're really terrible, heinous acts. And in that case, was that, you know, did that ensure separation of the two parties or the multiple parties from the person who was the complainant or the victim?
Both of those cases are public records. So if you're interested, they are available for viewing on our website. One of them, I would say, was a result of a long-standing history of conduct violations, as well as the egregiousness of the injury to a person. And the hazing violation impacted many, many students. And so it was a very egregious hazing. So I think it's a combination of both of that, from what I remember from the decisions of the boards. And both of those cases were presidential appeals. I mean, they went all the way up.
Thank you.
If no one has anything else on this, I'm going to remove the limitless option, and I will make the option between up to 3 years or up to 5 years, unless someone feels so strongly about keeping a potential limitless option. So what I'll ask people to do is, if you support the up to 3 years option, do the green check mark, and if you support the up to 5 years option, do the red X. Or just put it in the chat for me. Okay, by a vote of 2-5, the committee supports an up to 5 year option for suspension. Thank you for that. So the next one is in section 2. Should we add restitution as one of them for individuals as a mitigating or as a potential thing? I'm trying to find it here. Potential sanction. Yeah. And that might have been put in, but I'm not sure. So yeah, it's a just a simple, should we add restitution in full / part to sanctions that can be applied to individual students? I think I'm on the correct part. Yeah, Risa.
I mean, as a general matter, it seems fine to me, but I guess my concern is, I guess one question is restitution, does that always mean financial restitution? Is there some other kind of restitution it could be? But the other thing that I have a concern about is that that's a very unequal way in which that kind of sanction would fall on people. And we already have the fines provision. So, you know, depending on somebody's economic circumstances, that may be, the restitution may be far more serious for somebody who doesn't have money than somebody who comes from, let's say, a wealthy family.
Yeah, Gabrielle.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I feel particularly strong about this in either direction, but I just wanted to explain a situation that I've seen this year where we had restitution kind of considered for a respondent. That respondent was more likely then to try to become a complainant because it was like an altercation between two individuals, and because that person, you know, then wanted some sort of restitution as well because they felt harmed. So I think it has the potential to actually escalate the situation between the parties and make it a little bit more contentious, I guess. So again, I don't feel necessarily strongly, but I do think that's something that the committee should consider.
Yeah, Jen.
I would just, you know, consider a student who maybe had their laptop stolen and we know who did it and we're holding them responsible. A fine of $20 doesn't make good to the poor student whose laptop was stolen. There should be some responsibility of the person who took it to either return it or purchase a new one for them. And you can put it, if it's the worry of the student with less means, what if it was their laptop that was stolen, right? So I guess we could look at it both ways. If we know who did something and we know what the behavior was and they've admitted it and we've researched it and done due diligence, I think restitution is the right thing.
I'd just invite Gabriella or Christina or Bennett is also on if he handled that case. I mean, in that situation where you thought it was going to escalate it, did restitution end up getting imposed? Did it escalate it? Because I think it's important to remember with sanctions and remedies, we're talking about options. I think the JA would be, our office would be reluctant to impose restitution in a case where it, it so far exceeded a student's means to do that or seemed unfair. Sometimes restitution won't be the right sanction or the right remedy. We're talking about what option should be on the table. And for the reasons Jen just said, and otherwise, it seems like restitution should be an option. Sometimes that's going to be the best and the easiest thing.
Yeah, Risa?
I'm good with that. Just wanted to say that. Also, to take a moment just to mention before I forget again, that I made some suggestions for changes based on other, you know, wording stuff, but the substantive one I wanted to mention is I just started using expulsion instead of dismissal in my suggestions because that was suggested. So I made those changes all through, and I noticed that in our document on the substantive prohibitions that there is some place that would need to be changed as well. But I was assuming everybody would be okay with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think that's fine. The only thing I just could caution when you talk about organizations, that language of suspension works, but actually neither expulsion nor dismissal work for organizations. So just
I didn't make the change for them.
Yeah.
Great. So I'll ask for a vote on for individuals, should we add restitution in full/part for the committee? Yes, if you do want to add it, no, if you don't want to add it as sanctions potentially for individuals. Great. As a vote of 7-0, we'll be adding restitution in full/part as something, as a sanction imposed for individuals. The next we have our sanctions for organizations. We have 4 of them. Restitution in full/part, oral warning, probation, and suspension. So I'll start with restitution in full/part. I don't know if there needs to be discussion on that since it was done, but if anyone has anything. Seeing none, I'll ask for the vote on restitution in full/part for organization. So yes, if you want to add, no, if you don't want to add. Great, 7-0 on that, thank you. The next we have our oral warnings. So if anyone has anything on that. Risa, I do see there is a question in the comments that you asked, how is an oral warning recorded? And I wanna give the OJA time to potentially respond to that question.
An oral warning is, would be reflected in somebody's internal record, but I'll have anybody, including, Christina and Vin, correct me, but we don't report out oral warnings as a disciplinary record.
Okay. I asked that question, in terms of, I think there was a question of whether oral warnings for individuals.
Oh, okay.
It says imposed or deferred. And Christina had said it didn't seem to make much sense to defer an oral warning, which seemed reasonable. It seemed reasonable to me. So, you know, I just thought, well, if I knew what exactly happens with an oral warning, then maybe imposed or deferred for it, oral warning doesn't make sense. Just oral warning would probably be okay.
Yeah, just a reminder that when all those places that it says Christina, I don't want to put her on the hook for all those comments. She was reflecting the combined. It's because I didn't know how, and you could see I didn't know how last night to indicate that it's my name. So, but in any case, I actually was the one who said I didn't know if it made sense to do a deferred oral warning, because an oral warning doesn't get reported out. It's not considered it's not reportable as a disciplinary record. So I don't know what it means to have a deferred or a warning, but you know what? I don't feel strongly about that if people want to leave that in.
Well, I don't feel strongly either. I mean, I think it's fine to get rid of imposed or deferred if it's kind of doesn't make sense to say one or the other. It's an oral warning or it's not.
Okay. I'll make a note of that. So when I'm cleaning, I'll delete that from the oral warnings. But again, if no one else has adding oral warnings as a potential sanction for organizations, I'll ask for the vote. Yes, if you want to add it. No, if you don't want to add it.
Wait, I'm a little confused. Are we talking about the same thing? Because I thought it sounds like we're discussing the common bubble that's under individuals and not organizations.
It kind of blended into that because the way the comments are showing up on the doc, I thought it applied. I thought Reese's question was in regard to the organizations, but when you actually clicked on it, it brought me back up to individuals. So that was just like a technical error, but we're on this current comment.
Got it.
So yes, if you do want to add oral warnings for organizational sanctions, or no, if you don't want to add it. Okay, by a vote of 5-2, we will be adding oral warnings as potential sanction. The next one we have is probation. Yep, Risa.
So I would find it useful to have probation explained. Is it the same for, is it the same as using the term disciplinary probation for an individual? Or is there something different about probation for organizations?
Well, you'll see that I asked I think this question of what probation means comes up in other places too. It comes up notably later on in the conversations about whether hearing panels should hear cases where suspension and expulsion are on the table, or also questions where probation are on the table. So for me, probation means that students are on notice, if you will, that they should not, that should they engage in further misconduct, there could be a more serious sanction. Our office also has worked and developed really, I think, an impressive protocol and program that I've had absolutely nothing to do with. All the credit goes to the people in the OJA's office, especially Jeannie Bosch, and it's a probation curriculum that we've had some pretty good feedback on. So it's an opportunity for, you know, I suppose it's forced in some way as any of these sanctions are, but it's an opportunity for reflection. And we've actually had some really good feedback from students who have gone through that process. So that's how I'd answer it for now. I don't know if there's a follow-up question.
I actually do have a question. Might as well ask it now, like you said, because I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just am. but just since it's on the table now, and like Barb was saying, we'll be returning to it again. So the probation is, like, as you said, sort of a warning to people there might be something more severe next time. Does that tend to mean next time would be suspension or possibly expulsion? Or is there something else that could be more severe next time?
I don't think it necessarily means suspension or expulsion. You'd have to ask people who sit on hearing boards how they would interpret that. But I think it could mean some additional, I mean, all of the other options that are on the table could come into play. It could mean some community service work. It could mean a fine. It could mean a deferred suspension. It could mean any of the options that are on the table, but I think the code does reflect, I don't know if the language is still in here or not in this version that we're working with, but I think there's a concept in general that when people are in the office on more than one occasion, that sanctions become progressively severe, because whatever the educational component is that we're trying to achieve, something's not clicking. And so as students, you know, don't seem to realize their obligations to participate in a responsible way in the community, there may be more successively serious sanctions the more often they're in the office.
Yeah, Lisa.
I'll actually defer. I see that Gabrielle has her hand up, and I'm guessing that, you know, she may have some experience to share, so I'm happy to wait.
Okay, Gabrielle.
I was just going to answer what Barb said about it, there being multiple, like the language in there having, if you have been in the office multiple times, the sanctions will increase. I actually did not add that language into this, because it seemed like from feedback from the JA's office that provision, that language in the code had been kind of misinterpreted over the years to make people think that, like, you could actually get suspended faster than you were. So that was the only comment I was going to add. But that language is not in this version.
Yeah, maybe this would be a good one. I'm trying to just be efficient for people. But Christina, if you've got more experience there that is relevant to this question, please chime in.
The only thing I would add is just, you know, for probation, there is a length of time you're on probation. So it could be that if there's a subsequent violation, maybe a longer period of probation. But it really is case by case, because there could be different violations that have nothing to do with the underlying case that resulted in the student being placed on probation. And I appreciate that omission, Gabrielle. Thank you.
Rita.
Yeah, I guess I really am trying to understand what it means, because I, as a student, if I, certainly academically, if I'm on probation, then I basically know that if academically I'm on an academic probation, that I may actually be told to leave if I don't get off of probation and come back later, or never, you know? And so my concern here is, I think, sort of the everyday understanding of what a disciplinary probation would be, that you're on probation in a way that relates to either, you know, a potential suspension or something more severe than that. I it would never occur to me that, oh, the next time I might get a fine. So I'm a little concerned about the definition of the disciplinary probation. I don't actually know what it means.
Anything else on this aspect?
Well, can somebody explain it to me? I realize that you've said some things, but and maybe I'm the only person who doesn't understand what it means to be told you're on disciplinary probation.
Yeah, Christina, I see your hand.
Go ahead, Christina.
So the way I've always explained to a student is that if you're placed on disciplinary probation, there's two elements of it. One piece is that if there's any subsequent violation of the code, the JA's office reserves the right to escalate sanctions further. And I think that gives us a little bit more wiggle room to determine that, you know, hey, the subsequent violation could have something directly related to your previous violation. So what's going on there? Or it could be a situation where the subsequent violation has nothing to do with your prior behavior. The other component of probation is for a student to go through the probation curriculum. So I think it's a combination of this challenge and support that we're providing the student, is like, hey, listen, you're kind of heading towards a bad path here, but we're also going to provide this curriculum to better support you. It includes multiple check-ins so that we're staying in touch with this student. And I would say there have been some development in trying to create a probation curriculum for a student organization as well. And I think it's actually very critical for student organizations that if there's a progression in their violations, whether it be event management type things or smaller things, there's that potential for it to continue to grow if we don't provide that support. So I actually think probation is very important to include it as an option for organizations.
Gabrielle, did you have something to add?
Yeah, I was just so similar to the way Christina was explaining that. I would just kind of, in a conversation with a student about what is different between disciplinary probation than a written reprimand, which I would say is like the next under. So with a written reprimand, it's more of like an administrative kind of sanction. So there's some sort of record that is maintained. As of right now, I think this changes under this, under what is currently up for public comment, that would be changed. But there's some sort of record that's kept that can be reported out. Whereas with the disciplinary probation, the component that's added is much more of an extended interaction with the JA's office for however long that disciplinary probation lasts. And so there will be meetings with their office, opportunities to learn more about the code. So it's more of like a continued interaction with the JA's office rather than just the sanctions kind of end when they're administered.
Anything else on this for anyone?
But I will also say, I actually like really did not understand what disciplinary probation was until I got to see what the curriculum actually looks like for disciplinary probation. So I will say, I think it's very confusing and kind of a black box without viewing the curriculum. I mean, we've tried to do a much better job this year of explaining it. But as a JCC last year, I had no idea what disciplinary probation was, I think, until I saw the curriculum.
Yeah, Risa.
So I would suggest that someplace in here, in the code, that we have an explanation of what disciplinary probation means, because it's clear that it's not clear right, until you know what it is, and also the order of it does appear, at least I don't know if the order is correct in terms of how we have the sanctions, but it appears that things are put in there in order of escalation, so that the kind of next time if something happens, you know, you get a more severe sanction. It would be also good if that could be explained, like what is the potential for the next time if you've been on disciplinary probation and you have another violation.
Yeah, there was. And I think that's important. I think there are some concepts in here, and I think there were some comments from the OJA asking for, you know, side documents that were more simplified explanations of things, or things that could greater explain concepts and things like that, of like different terms in the procedures. And I think that's something that we should definitely do. And I would highly recommend that. I think it would just provide a lot more transparency to students who are going through the process. It's like, oh, I don't want to read 20 pages. I would rather just, here's a flow chart of what my process would look like potentially, or, you know, just various supplemental documents that can really allow students to say, here's it on face value, but if I want to go deeper, I can go deeper into, you know, the OJA's website or like a supplementary document. But yeah, I agree, an explanation of disciplinary probation with maybe like potentially like what the curriculum looks like, I think that supplemental document would be helpful in this regard. So if there's nothing else on probation, I will ask the committee yes to add, no to not add. Kat Nutre and Andrea, I'm waiting on your votes.
Joe, there's no abstain option, so I don't know if we should have an abstain option or how we would do that if we did want to abstain.
If you wanted to abstain, the way I typically do it is like message me privately.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I'm going to clock it in at 6-0 for probation, disciplinary probation. So the next one is suspension of organizations. And I'm assuming if when we add suspension, it will be with that up to 5 year, you know, up to 5 year policy that we voted on earlier. So anything
I just want to say, and I don't mean to muddy the waters here, but as I've, you know, suspending a student organization, especially so one of the hard things for me coming in and doing this right when I've just started as an interim is the inability to have conversations on all these important topics with people across campus. Especially in the context of fraternities and sororities where they have a system for reviewing conduct. And so I just want to be transparent about that and put that on the table. I have not had a conversation with the folks in fraternity, sorority and fraternity life, or even with student and campus life more broadly to understand their thoughts on whether the student conduct process ought to have the ability to suspend or dismiss an organization. It's interesting because we have, I guess I would say it this way though, currently this recommendation says that this student conduct process can, you know, rescind permission to operate. So if they have permission to rescind their ability to operate and terminate their relationship with the university, then it seems to me this process ought to be able to do things less serious than that. I just wanted to be transparent about what I've had a chance to talk with people about and whatnot.
And in the interim period, we can reach out to OSFL and campus activities to gather their thoughts for our next Friday meeting during the public comment period to, you know, make sure that everything we're recommending is in line with what they see in their practice. Any other thoughts on adding suspension? Seeing none, I'll ask for, perfect. Seeing none, I'm going to ask for a vote on suspension. Yes to add, no to not add. And if you want to abstain, just message me privately. Do a couple more. Give it a minute. Cat and Uche. There we go. Okay. By a vote of 6-0, suspension will be added. The next one we have is in section 4.3. Should transcript notation be added while the conduct process, any part, is in progress? It applies to this comment from the OJA. And subsequent comments. So if people have initial questions on it, you know, ask the questions or have initial thoughts, go for it. Yep, Risa.
Because, you know, my concern on the transcript notation is this kind of public statement of pending charges. You know, it does seem to be quite punitive, even though it says pending. It's quite severe, and it seems to me that the proposed language does provide for withholding the degree until after the resolution of a formal complaint if the respondent does not enter into a separate agreement to resolve it.
Gabrielle.
So this comes from conversations that the faculty have had about policy 6.4. So two law school professors recently spoke with the faculty senate about essentially adding this to policy 6.4 because it avoids situations where the student is going to graduate or transfer or something that would otherwise cause the university to lose jurisdiction to resolve the complaint. But it prevents that from happening. And so then the entire formal complaint can be resolved, but the student can still leave without the notation or can still receive their degree while it's pending. I don't think this comes up nearly as much in the code as it does with policy 6.4, because there have been a lot of cases recently where students are either they graduate during the pending complaint or it begins essentially when they graduate. But I do think that this allows, you know, the whole purpose of creating some sort of hold on their degrees so that the university can seek that resolution for both the university and the complainant if there is one. And so this seems to me like a way to balance all of those concerns on all sides.
Jen.
I was just going to add that as a former dean of students, when we would put these transcript notes on when students would try and transfer, or I wouldn't want to receive a student at my institution if they had really serious conduct charges at another institution pending, right? Because they didn't resolve that. And I don't know if I'm bringing a concern onto my campus, either a safety concern or a 6.4 Title IX concern. And those markers really do help in those processes, both what Gabrielle said is to complete the process, but also should a student try and transfer, it does protect other students from what could potentially be really dangerous behavior.
I saw Barb's hand.
Yeah, so in addition to what Jen said, which I think is important, I just think we have to understand it obviously is a significant limitation for somebody who finds themselves facing conduct proceedings toward the end of their time at Cornell, for sure. I don't disagree with that. It's also true that if that student is allowed to get their diploma and leave, so if the judicial hold isn't an option, there really is no, there, then the university has no ability to resolve that. We have no authority. Let's say we enter into a summary decision agreement, and I'd like to talk about what it means to attempt to enter into an agreement first so that we would understand what that meant. Because I think a lot of times in those situations, students who are about to graduate don't have any real incentive to come into the JA's office or even to respond. So, but beyond that, what do we do with the potentially serious student conduct matter that happens toward the end of a, you know, soon to be graduating senior? We sign an agreement with them, we give them their diploma, maybe that agreement has some sanctions. Once they have their diploma, there's no ability for the university to hold them to that agreement. And that can have real repercussions for people who are on the campus, who have been the subject of that in terms of their perceptions of whether this is a fair system or not. I don't know how it feels hollow to me. Once they have their degree. It seems better to require not just that they would do their agreement, but they have to complete whatever sanctions. You know, if we went this route at all, they have to complete their sanctions before they get their degree.
Okay. Anyone else?
Risa.
Risa. Risa.
Okay, I was just looking at the current code on compliance issues. The current one does allow for some notations about, it does say an official transcript issued during the pendency of charges shall indicate that charges are pending, accompanied by a complete recitation of the pending charges, which I think is really pretty extreme. But then later it does say no official transcript or degree will be granted to any person who has been found in violation of this code and who has not fulfilled any condition or requirement fixed as a penalty or remedy, but such official transcript or degree shall be granted upon fulfillment of all such outstanding obligations. So I'm wondering if it would make sense to do some change in the language here to include that. I'd be interested in hearing Gabrielle's thoughts on this in particular, because I'm not really sure, you know, just based on people's experience, how this works. Would it make sense to withhold the degree until after resolution of the formal complaint or resolution of a separate agreement with the university as opposed to simply entering the separate agreement?
So this is Barb, I'm jumping in, excuse me, Gabrielle, but this does say that the agreement has to include, including the completion of sanctions agreed to or imposed. So that language may be in here. But I stand by my comments earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it seems, Risa, that your suggestion would allow for, like, if the student doesn't respond, or the concern about, like, what does attempt mean? Like, if the student isn't responsive, then the degree could be withheld. It sounds like, based on the suggestion you just made. So I would support that. I just think giving the option where students are working with the office, they are just, you know, they're just trying to get through the process. And if they're going to fulfill their sanctions, I don't see the reason to over punitively withhold their degree, especially if they haven't been completely resolved through the process yet and been given some sort of sanctions, just based on the timing of it. It just seems overly punitive.
So are you saying that you could, there could be a hold on the degree if there's serious misconduct and they have a sanction, but they haven't fulfilled the sanction, but the university can't withhold a degree if the process is still pending?
No, I'm saying, I mean, Risa would have to maybe repeat the language she just said, or maybe like type it out in the chat box, but it sounded like her suggestion was, you know, either the student responds and works with the office during the pending formal complaint and in the completion of the sanctions, and they enter into a separate agreement to retain jurisdiction, or if the student does not work with the office, then the office can withhold the degree either during the pending formal complaint or during the completion of sanctions, was how I understood Reese's language.
I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm just asking whether this language is sufficient as worded based on, you know, some of the concerns people are raising, and if there's anything that we can do to alleviate those concerns without placing the notation on the transcript or without overdoing the withholding of the degree, you know, not going too far.
I have Jen, Bryce, and Christina.
I'm in favor of the transcript notation, and I also think about things that students may apply for, and I don't know, Laura, about study abroad, but I know at my former institution, if you had pending conduct charges, you couldn't go abroad. If you had pending conduct charges, there were other things that you couldn't do until you resolved them. And I'm not thinking about people who are about to graduate, right? I'm thinking maybe it's a first year or second year. So I'm just in favor of having the note there until the charge is resolved.
Yeah, Jen, so am I. So I'm thinking maybe we could just vote on it and see how people land.
Wait, before the vote, though, if I could just add. So the difference, though, the current code essentially allows a transcript notation for any process or anything, which is not really the practice that's even done now. And so what I'm saying is the current code is written in such a way that the JA could add a transcript notation for any violation, regardless, which is
current
not
code or this code that we're reading?
the existing code. So I just want to make sure that when the vote is happening, like, it's very clear as to what people are voting for, whether it's like falling back on the existing code, the proposed code, because the existing code is way more expansive than this.
Okay. I'm going to let Bryce and Christina and then the vote, if that's okay with everyone. So I'll give it to Bryce.
So my question is following off on Gabrielle, because that was exactly my concern too, is, you know, I agree with Jen, but to an extent, but if someone is just going through the process, then I'm not sure the transcript notation seems like an overkill to me. So it seems to me that we might need the transcript notation or the withholding of the degree if the person doesn't fall through with the office or doesn't enter a separate agreement. But what about the case where they just started the process? I don't think we want the transcript notation.
And then Christina.
So maybe this might be a point of clarification, is at the current process we have right now, a transcript notation is placed when something is charged to a hearing, which is a very small number of cases. It's not the situation where somebody is provided notice that you may have been drinking in a residence hall and there's a transcript notation on your student account. That's not the case. And the only thing I would say, I don't want to repeat anything anybody else has said, is that the current code allows for transcript notations. And what I'm seeing is proposed, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it says that we cannot place a transcript notation. So it seems to me there's a middle ground that we might want to reach, is what are the circumstances that might be appropriate for a transcript notation and what triggers that? I think that's really important, because holding a diploma doesn't really mean anything unless you've completed your academic requirements, you know. Even if we don't hold your diploma, maybe you can't get your diploma because you haven't finished your academic requirements. So it really is isolated to a situation of perhaps a graduating senior, versus a transcript notation is something to transcript in the event that somebody wants to transcript. I think those are the differences.
So if I may, everyone, because it does appear like middle ground, instead of saying, the language could say the OSCCS may place a notation on respondent's transcript if going through a hearing panel process. Maybe that's not the most elegant of language, but I think it captures how people might feel. Yeah, Gabrielle.
I still think that's too expansive, because that's what currently happens. And my interpretation of that sort of policy always has been that you're essentially punishing a student for exercising their rights to the fullest extent. If they decide that they disagree with an agreement proposed by the JA's office and would like to go to a hearing, that their transcript has a notation out until the hearing, the way that the current practice, which this is not in the code, but this is just practice, that until the hearing panel decision is rendered, until it's written, that the student has a notation, which means that the student is beholden to the administrator or the administrative panel or the hearing panel. What am I trying to say? Not the panel, the chair. They're beholden to the chair to write the decision. So it just seems like it's not even related anymore to what it is meant to fulfill. There's too many just like extenuating circumstances.
Risa.
Also, I heard Christina saying that from what I understand from what Christina said, that she was saying that she thought this transcript notation is really limited to the instance of somebody graduating, and whether the university could assert any power over somebody who's graduating. So, and I heard Jen saying something very different, which is, you know, from the moment you're here, perhaps there should be a transcript notation. So I think that your suggestion, Joe, of, you know, if something is going to a hearing is still very broad in relation to what I hear Christina saying. So, I mean, I would keep this as it is at this point, because I don't think we have an alternative that is sufficiently narrow. But if somebody comes up with alternate language, I think we could consider it.
I'll let Christina explain a little bit more.
I don't know that I have much more to explain. I was just going to clarify that's not what I was saying. I was saying there's a difference between students with a transfer notation who may be in the middle of their academic career, who may want to transfer, and that's why that transfer notation is important in a pending case, versus a graduating senior holding their degree is another level of saying, you know, you do need to complete these sanctions and whatnot before you depart. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. So for this one, I'm trying to think, because I don't think they're, so I'm just going to ask for a vote on this question, and I think that's the only way we can get through it. I think we can make a note, and if people don't, so yes, if you want to keep the language as is, no, if you don't want to keep the language, and in the no, when we, you know, send it, or when we come back to this, maybe after public comment, we can revise it. So yes, if you want to keep it, no, if you don't want to keep it, and, you know, we can put explaining points at the end of this meeting or as we write the report and stuff like that to the UA. So, okay.
Joe, can you say that one more time?
Yeah. So yes, if you want to keep the language currently written, currently as written. No, if you would like to see it changed, and we can work on those changes, you know, at another meeting during the public comment period. So like next Friday, or we can put more points in for when we send that to the UA. So it's basically like the kind of no, we want it to change. We just haven't figured out the best change to make yet. So that would be a no. And if you want to abstain, just put it in the chat, like message me privately. Did we?
So this is like a, this is for all violations, not just the ones that are crimes of violence where we're mandated to note, correct?
I would assume so. That's how I'm reading it.
Okay, perfect.
Also, we seem to have lost Risa in this process. Oh. There she is. She's back. So yes, if you want to keep the language as is, no, if you would like to see a change, and we could further elaborate the change at a later meeting.
Can I just say, I'm really sorry I got dropped out and I had to just get back in. So what are we doing?
So we're voting on the transcript notation language. So yes, if you would like to keep it as written, or no, if you would like to see a change, and we will work on that change at a later meeting during the public comment period, and we'll make a note on it when we put that to public comment. So the vote I have recorded is 3-5 in keeping the language. The group of five, I will make note of, and we'll come back to this at our next Friday's meeting. When we put this to public comment, I will be kind of just putting a note. It's just saying the vote is 3-5. Three members believe that this language should be as written, and five members believe there should be a change in a different direction. So I'll just make a note of that. So the next part I had wasn't necessarily a question, but was kind of a quick description of the administrative panel. And Risa, you did that. If you would like to kind of explain kind of that process. Kind of what you put there in section 5.1.
Great. Do you have it showing?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, okay, here it is. Yeah. I'm not completely sure if this belongs exactly here because it's kind of introducing the overall hearing processes, but I didn't see any place else to put it. And this is where the placeholder was. So, I'm hoping that it's self-explanatory. The notion is before somebody dives into reading the whole thing, the different panels to explain that the administrative panel, because the sanctions potentially that you would be given are less severe, that goes along with the notion of a proceeding that is also less elaborate in regard to the calling of witnesses, that a lot of it's going to be done on paper. So it seems to me that, and Gabrielle and I had talked about this before, and I think we talked about it in the meeting, that might be helpful to a person who's reading this to say, oh, I see, this is the reason why they're different. My thought on the disciplinary probation piece here, and you know, we've had some discussion on this already, was that seemed to be a pretty severe sanction. It's obviously not as bad as getting thrown out of school for some period of time or permanently, but my thought was that you should be able to go to a full hearing, but I guess that's, you know, something for us to decide.
Yeah, I'll let that that decision be for right now for about 10 minutes if people want to discuss. So, Barb, it was your comment why disciplinary probation is put in the same category as suspension and expulsion, if you want to elaborate a bit more on that as to your thoughts.
Yeah, sure. I think this is, to me, this is a big question. I appreciate the notion of trying to have some less involved process than a full-blown hearing for cases where the J's office, renamed, can't reach an informal resolution and a hearing. And I guess that's what this administrative panel procedure is intended to do, is to have something more narrowly focused, kind of on the record resolution and determination of sanctions. For me personally, I will just say the difference between an administrative panel and a hearing panel seems to be it's on the record and it's one fewer person. I don't know whether that's, I see Risa shaking her head, but I guess to me there's a lot of extra process with this administrative panel procedure for cases, and I don't know, that's what this group, I would encourage this group to look at whether or not that's a good trade-off. But I will continue to say on the specific piece of disciplinary probation, it seems to me if you want to have a more involved process for suspension and expulsion, I personally disagree with that. But I wouldn't object to that. But I don't think that disciplinary probation ought to rise to the level where it goes to a full hearing, if that's the distinction that you're trying to make.
Gabrielle.
Yeah, I can just give like a quick compare and contrast if that would be helpful to people. I don't want to go into it though if it's not helpful, just between the process of the two. Yes. Okay. So if we're starting at like the beginning of the process, so what the pre-hearing submissions will look like, the pre-hearing submissions are less extensive in the administrative panels. They require just like a summary basically of the investigation from the JA's office. Then the respondent has an opportunity to respond in writing to that, but that essentially serves as their opening statement. And they can request witnesses of the panel. The panel decides which witnesses will actually be there. Then if you compare that to the larger hearings, the exchange of witnesses and exhibits happens in the pre-hearing stage, and there's not as much filtering from the panel. There can be objections made on both sides as to what should be considered that the chair can then decide on, but there's not that filtering mechanism, and the opening statement would not be written. So then if you get to the actual hearing for the administrative panels, there is no opening statement because that was already written. The respondent has the right to testify, but if the panel decided that no other witnesses were required, then no other witnesses would be called, and so it would just be the respondent. You compare that to the larger hearings, there would be an opening statement on both sides. the witnesses would be called on both sides as they've decided which witnesses should be considered. And then for both hearings, there would be an oral closing statement that I think, and then moving to the sanctions phase. So if the administrative panel hearing, the student would just write an impact statement. So the student and the JA's office would not wait around for the result. Whereas with the larger hearings, everyone would wait for the result of whether the student was found responsible or not, and then be able to tailor their sanctions arguments directly to the findings. That's more significant in the larger cases because if someone is facing a hazing allegation for multiple things or, you know, a huge breadth of violations, which would be those that would trigger like suspension or dismissal, the student might not be found responsible for everything. So that gives them some time to understand like how to make their arguments. So big picture, those are the differences in the process.
Sorry, Risa, yeah, I was muted.
Okay, I just want to mention that put in, I'm really sorry about this squeak. I've got to put the dog upstairs whenever we have a break because she's using her squeaky toy back there. But this addition of the administrative panel was to a great extent in response to the OJA's office and what we understood, not exactly the same, but the concept that we understood from when Michelle was the JA. And so it was trying to be responsive in that way to say most hearings will be an administrative panel hearing. Few hearings will go to a full hearing panel. So it was designed to try to do that, to make it more on paper for the administrative panel, to make it more discretionary for whether you need the witness's testimony, and to streamline and shorten the hearings. But if it seems like too much process and we just want to make everything go to a full hearing, I would be fine with that. But I just want to point out that the reason was actually to try to be responsive to what we were hearing from the OJA's office.
Yeah, Christina, I saw your hand.
So thank you for bringing that up, Risa. I think when we were going through this proposal from the JA's office, what was perhaps envisioned was an administrative panel process that was completely in writing. And the reason that was proposed, the two very, very different hearings, was that we don't have a lot of hearings right now, and we thought that maybe there would be more individuals who would choose a hearing option. Especially one that was not so formal. And, you know, to me, I think some of the procedures that are in place makes it seem more like there's a full hearing and then kind of this semi-hearing, as opposed to a full hearing and then a written submission type of administrative panel. So.
Yeah, Risa.
Yeah, I mean, I don't actually think that we are all that far apart on this administrative panel, because it will be up to the panel whether they want to hear from other witnesses other than the respondent. I think the respondent should have a chance to testify if the respondent wants to. But, you know, the panel could say, well, you know, we think we've got enough on paper here and we're not going to hear from witnesses. I mean, for me, I mean, I like the idea of somebody having a full choice of a full hearing. So to me, that was like a major, major concession in terms of the level of due process I prefer. So I think the thing of, oh, it's just going to be on paper is way too truncated. But the ability of somebody to say, in addition to my own ability to speak as the respondent, here are some other people I'd like you to hear from, and the hearing panel the administrative panel might say, well, no, we don't really think we need that. We think we've got enough. But like I said, you know, if people want to just have the full hearing, that's fine with me.
I'm going to give this discussion like a couple more minutes. Again, the question is, should disciplinary probation be in the hearing panels or the administrative panel process? So just a couple more minutes if people have extra thoughts, and then we'll take like a quick 5-minute break.
Can I just say something, Joe?
Bryce and Risa, yeah.
Oh, sorry, Risa, you were muted. But I just wanted to ask how often disciplinary probation is envisioned as a sanction, and how often it's currently used.
So the answer to how often it's currently used, I would have to. I have reviewed the annual reports, but I didn't commit them to memory before I started. So I'll defer to Christina to answer that question. I will say, in terms of disciplinary probation, I think that is. I think this curriculum. I can't give you a number. I believe that over the past 3 years, during the time that Michelle Horvath was the JA, that there was disciplinary probation. I think we checked at one point and it was something like 55 cases over 3 years. I don't have a sense of, I see Christina wants to look at that, wants to chime in. Vin may know an answer to that also.
Christina?
We were just talking about this yesterday, actually. This semester we have three. Last academic year, so I'm looking at the public, the annual report. Last academic year, there were 8. And this is a very, very small percentage is what I'm saying, because we have over 800 referrals to the office. It's a very, very small percentage, and even smaller for suspensions and dismissals, which is generally appropriate.
Vin has just texted me to clarify that it's was about 55 cases over 4 years, not 3 years, and it sounds like that has been being used less frequently in recent years, if I can put that together with Christina's.
Risa?
Yeah, I was just going to comment, and to a great extent, I think this is I don't know why exactly this happened, but that our discussion did kind of morph into whether we should have these two separate hearings processes. And so I kind of lost track of that. The only thing we're voting on now is, if we have the two separate processes, where does disciplinary probation belong? Is that right?
Having a hearing process and an administrative process, where does, I have Jen, Gabrielle, and then I'll ask for a vote on this question, and then we'll take a short break.
I was just going to say, Joe.
No, go for it.
I was just going to say that pulling disciplinary probation into a hearing panel just seems it's just not in the right spot. I believe a hearing panel should be resolved or reserved for any time a student could be separated from the university, or it's a very serious violation, and a disciplinary probation, I don't think, falls in the same level of a suspension and an expulsion. It seems like opposite ends of the sanctioning guidelines to me.
Gabrielle?
Yeah, so I just sent the PDF for the most recent annual report in the chat. And if you look at page 14 through 16, that's kind of where all these statistics are located for the last two academic years, if people are curious. But I think, so it seems like there's kind of two considerations here. One is making this process more approachable to students, more efficient, and then there's the other side of considering what the severity of the sanctions are like. So on the kind of approachability efficiency side, I think it is really important to recognize, if you look at these statistics, that these are like 1% of sanctions. So we're not talking about a lot of cases here that would, you know, clog up the system, I guess. On the other side of severity, although, you know, certainly a break from the university is very significant for students, when you're drawing the line between a year-long or a semester-long disciplinary probation and a one-semester suspension, to me, I struggle for some students to see what the difference might be. I mean, there's obviously a huge difference. But when you're drawing lines just arbitrarily between a one semester suspension and a disciplinary probation that could last a year, you know, it does seem serious enough where the student should be able to bring all the witnesses that they want.
Okay. So I'm going to ask for a vote on this one. Yes, if you want to keep disciplinary probation at the hearing panel level. No, if you want to move it to the administrative panel level. And abstain, just message me. And then we'll take a break. So go for it. Kat and Uche waiting on you. Okay. So 5-2, it will be staying at the hearing panel level. And when we come back from our 5-minute break, we'll be starting on K, section 5-3. Section 5-2, I realized wasn't necessarily a question, just like a consistency in formatting thing. So take a 5-minute break. We'll come back.
Wait, sorry. So it's 5-2 to stay at the hearing panel or 5-2 to go to the administrative panel?
Yeah, 5-2 to stay at the hearing panel.
I don't know that that was what people realized they were voting for, because Risa voted to keep it at the hearing panel, which is opposite of what she's saying. Is that consistent with what people thought they were voting for?
I thought I was voting to keep it at the full hearing panel.
I voted to move it to administrative.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. Okay, just checking. Yeah. I was confused by that.
Yeah, people knew what they were. Yes, so probation will stay at the hearing panel level from a 5-2 vote. When we come back, we'll be starting with K on the agenda. And so if everyone could be back at 12:40, that would be fantastic. Thanks. Taking a quick count, it is 12:40 if people are back. That'd be great. And just give me some indication that you're back, whether it be turning your camera on, giving a little thumbs up, checkbox. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm back.
Perfect. Bryce is back. Get another minute here for everyone. I see movement. Yep. Kat, Uche, Mariah, you're back. Yeah. Good here. Okay. So it is 12:41. We'll go back to this. And we are starting back with K, which is located in section 5-3. Yeah, Barb.
Maybe I can shorten this one. We have reviewed this and we can waive any concerns that we have about section 5.3 and 5.6 in terms of presenting an administrative resolution.
Okay. If no one else has anything on that, I'll just cancel that question and mark it as resolved. Okay, great. Now moving on to section 5.4. Should the hearing proceed if the respondent doesn't show up? That is the question, and it's located in section 5-4. So, and the comment is up on the screen. So, any initial thoughts on that? Barb.
To ask, where are we looking? I'm having a little trouble figuring out what we're looking at.
It's a section 5-4. It's the first comment, so if you click on the highlighted portion.
Okay. Thanks.
Yep. Barb.
Yeah. So just a quick comment there, that just to, you know, the university doesn't have any subpoena power in campus conduct proceedings. So we think the fairest thing is that if a respondent has a right not to appear, for sure, we can't compel that respondent to appear. But if the respondent doesn't appear, the university should be allowed to go forward and make decisions about conduct, you know, alleged misconduct based on other evidence that's available. And we think the same should be true if a complainant doesn't respond or doesn't appear. The same should be true in both cases, but I don't want to confuse it. Maybe we'll stick to the respondent for now.
Any other thoughts on that? Yeah, Gabrielle.
I mean, I think that seems fine. I can't think of a reason why that shouldn't be like that. So just move this along.
Yeah, yeah. So I asked for a vote on it. Yes, if you want to include language that a hearing would proceed on the evidence presented if a respondent doesn't show up. No, if you don't want to include that language. Yeah, Risa, I see your hand. Or
I guess, oh. You know, I'm sorry to jump in when people are voting. I mean, I think it's generally okay, though. Is it going to be a may? Because usually, I think in those kinds of provisions, it would be something along the lines of, you know, unless there's sort of good cause shown for not showing up.
Yeah, I'll use the language that was in the comment. And it says may proceed. So that will be the language.
Okay.
So looking for everyone's votes on those. So 8-0, we'll be adding that. The next is also in section 5.4. The one that I have is from the OJA. It should formal rules of evidence apply, and that's also in some subsequent sections. Personally, when I read that, I don't know what formal rules of evidence are in these things. So if there could be a bit of an explanation as to what those are for everyone to be on the same page and then a proper discussion. So if Barb could take that or someone from the OJA.
Sure. In court proceedings, there's actually a document that there's the federal rules of evidence. Every state typically has their rules of evidence, or they say they abide by the federal rules of evidence. And it's just, it's a set of complicated rules that basically try to say what evidence is admissible and what isn't. This is to say, and I actually think I wrote this comment a while ago. I think it may say down at the general portion of this document, way down at the bottom, that the rules of evidence don't apply. It's basically saying these hearing panels can decide whatever evidence is relevant and relevant to these proceedings and reliable, and the hearing panel gets to decide that. So I
saw Gabrielle nodding her head along.
Yeah, so under 8.3, just because it didn't really fit under any specific hearing panel section, so it's just like the general hearing panel section, it says strict rules of evidence shall not apply under these procedures, blah, 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 and then it just lists a few things that that can be considered as, like, objections.
Okay. Risa?
I'd also note that I added actually almost verbatim what Barb just said to the general description so that people would see that in both hearing processes, the administrative panel and the hearing panel, that the evidence the rules of evidence are not applied strictly, or the strict rules of evidence are not applied, and I use the language of reliability and relevance.
I saw that, Lisa, that's why I just said it that way. I stole your language.
Well, good. I'm glad. You know, I think we're all in agreement on this. You know, we're not going to use here today. We're not, you know.
So I will consider that question moot, and we don't have to vote on it. The next one is also in section 5.4, and this also applies to subsequent sections, is should there be public hearings, kind of broadly? If someone wants to take that away. Yeah, Risa.
Okay, just to get started on it, you know, my sense is that the way this is written for any kind of hearing, that the public nature of the hearing and the ability to do it is limited enough so that, looking for the language here, so that if the panel chair in either kind of hearing, administrative or the hearing panel, determines that it would result in undue intimidation of a named complainer or the witnesses, that it won't be public, and that the chair can limit the number in the interest of preserving decorum and dignity. So, you know, I think that I've been here long enough so that my sense is that in some cases having things public was actually extremely important. And I mentioned this the last time when we talked about this, particularly when there are kind of broad university sort of issues involved that are political. For example, you know, during the divestment movement on campus, having public hearings was quite educational, actually, speaking of education. And it that didn't have to do with, you know, witnesses who were also sort of victims, you know, if we use that term, of an assault or something like that. It was really a broader issue. And those are the kinds of cases where I think people do want public hearings.
Jen, I saw your hand go up.
I took it back down.
Okay. Anyone else? Yeah, Barb.
So, you know, if this were, so I think our office starts from the premise that student conduct proceedings are confidential matters, and just like student education records are confidential, if the idea is to have transparency in the vast majority of, you know, individual student misconduct hearings, the I think creation of a public record satisfies the concern about transparency. I think the other place where I think this gets confusing or potentially problematic is in a case where you have a joint multiple number of respondents in a particular hearing. What do you do if someone wants it and someone doesn't? Yes, you can sever those hearing proceedings, but then you end up having multiple hearings about the same fact pattern because one respondent wanted a public hearing and the other didn't. And at least the exceptions that are stated here, I don't think are broad enough to allow a chair to deal with that, because the only question is if the respondent wants it public and the chair says the hearing wouldn't result in undue intimidation of named complainant or witnesses. There are also potentially others who might have an interest in that decision. But in the fundamentally, I think we just think that student conduct hearings should be private matters.
Okay. Jen.
I was just going to go off what I didn't know what Barb was going to say, but what she said is nobody has the option to recuse themselves, like none of the witnesses, the panel members, and that really puts a lot of people in a position where maybe they don't want to participate in a public way because of the confidential nature of a lot of these things. I just don't think it's fair to everybody who would be involved in the situation equally.
Yeah, Gabrielle.
I mean, I still think I like the option of having this in the code. And so I think there are a lot of logistical considerations here and very legitimate concerns. I just wonder if instead of writing it out completely of the code, that there's something in here saying like, if all participants agree, like if prompted by the respondent and if all participants agree or just something to at least give it an option, because it seems like maybe in those more like political hearings that Risa's referencing, it does see, I have no basis to think this, but to me it seems like there people might just agree, whereas in a massive hazing hearing, I don't think people would agree to have that public. So that's just a suggestion.
Risa?
Yeah, I mean, maybe we can do something with the language on the joint hearings. I mean, I think that's easy. You know, if you have joint hearings, all respondents would have to agree. I think that's easy to add. Or I guess a respondent who really wants it public could ask to have it severed. But so I think that's easy. And I think some language along the lines of giving the chair the discretion to consider matters such as the importance of maintaining confidentiality, not just the intimidation piece, but some sort of additional language of that way to give the, if that matter, to give the panel chair or the panel, well, actually we have the panel chair, but to give the panel chair the ability to consider particular concerns about confidentiality would address the concerns that people are raising.
Yeah, Barb.
I think, you know, I appreciate the effort to try to find a middle ground there. I don't think it accommodates, I think it's very tough to address the issue of witnesses who may choose, you know, even in a protest or demonstration case, there may be witnesses who don't want to participate in a public hearing. So I think you have to find a way to accommodate that and respectful. It might be easy to write in the piece about if there are joint respondents that there could be severed, but then what that means as a practical matter, I think becomes really difficult because you end up having, you know, one hearing, you end up doing the same hearing multiple times, or you could end up doing the same hearing about the same set of circumstances multiple times, potentially in front of two different panels, and that doesn't seem like a good option.
So I'm going to flip the question a bit, and just to get a better read on this and kind of do what we did with transcript notations. So the question I'm going to flip it to is, should all hearings be private? Yes, no. No meaning that there should be exceptions that we've talked about, and we'll make a note of that, and then we can come back to it next Friday with like more information to add, just to respect time. So if everyone's okay with that. So yes, I think all hearings should be private, or no, I don't think all hearings should be private. There should be exceptions as the vote. Uche, do you have a vote on this? I know Laura stepped away, so I'll ask her when she returns on this topic. Uche? One, two, hello? So as it currently stands, without Laura and Uche weighing in, 4-3 in favor of having all hearings be private. When Laura does come back, I'll get her vote to see if that changes anything. And I'll see if I can make contact with Uche on that. So just to note that, and that will be part, that will just be a note, and we'll come back to it next Friday with, if there's, depending on how Laura votes and depending on what some public comments say and everything like that. So just going to put that down as a marker for right now for everyone. The next one I have, Jen, this was a, oh, that relates to the public comment, so I think that was covered. So the next one I have is also in section 5.4 from the OJA, should all questions go through the chair? That was a suggestion. So Barb, if you want to explain a bit more what that would look like or what that would be.
Yeah, can I, I'm looking for where exactly, for all cases involving, so this is really, I think it's just important and helpful if a chair, not just in these cases involving interpersonal misconduct, but in all cases, the administrative chair, at a minimum, I think, should always have the option to say that direct questioning has to come through the chair. I think that creates a less adversarial process for everybody. So some codes I'm familiar with require that up front. They don't allow the parties. Every party can pose questions through the chair, but the chair sometimes will rephrase the question to make it less adversarial, may sometimes say, you know what, we've asked that question 3 or 4 times, we're not going to go over it again. It just gives the chair more discretion and more ability to make this into a less adversarial proceeding than it sometimes gets when there is direct questioning. So that my proposal was to at a minimum always allow the chair to do that in any type of case. A step beyond that would be to say that questions will always go through the chair.
Gabrielle.
So I think giving the chair the option is fine in all cases, but the big concern here is what happens in policy 6.4, which is that none of the questions sometimes that are submitted are asked because the chair can serve as such a strong filtering mechanism. So although I think giving the chair maybe the option to ask questions prevent the questioning from becoming too adversarial, I don't think that the chair should have a lot of discretion over either eliminating questions or rephrasing them to such an extent that goes beyond just preventing intimidation, because then the chair has control over the content of the hearing and you've removed that from the respondent and from, you know, the parties. So I, you know, giving the option in other cases and making it less restrictive in that way, I think is okay. But going beyond that just completely removes any opportunity for the respondent to ask the questions that they want to ask.
Mariah.
Yeah, I was kind of going to echo what Gabrielle said, just that I worry that, I worry when the chair has such a power over the question that questions that a party wants answered just aren't allowed to be answered because the chair deemed them as like not appropriate to be like questioned to the other party. And so I guess I don't feel comfortable with the chair having that much power over questions that get answered or questions that get quote unquote like not redrafted, what is the word I'm looking for, like kind of tweaked to make them less combative. But it's also like that was the person's question, and I don't think the chair should be changing like the question that the respondent or the complainant wants to ask.
Risa.
Yeah, thanks. Following on some of these comments, looking at the language, there is actually quite a lot of discretion already built into this. because we're talking about cases involving interpersonal misconduct where this could be a particular, you know, this could be a problem. And the examples are given aren't exhaustive. They're such as. And so this does give the chair the ability to enter in that, in those kinds of cases. And those, and that kind of power to the chair, I think is commensurate with the sort of case. So I think that this actually does give the chair quite a bit of discretion to do that.
Where's the such as language you're talking about? Oops. Sorry.
I had it somewhere. I thought.
Are you looking for the language?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at my own copy. It because I can see it. It's for cases involving. Yeah, right. That's where you are.
Yeah, right here. So that's where it would be.
Still has to be interpersonal conduct. It can't be other things.
Right. That's my point. Yeah.
Sorry. I'm in favor of it going through the chair. I think that there are times where you have to filter out questions that are blatantly inappropriate. It could be re-triggering. It could be something that, you know, violates people's rights just by asking it. It could be degrading. And I think that the chair does need to reserve the autonomy to decide that that question isn't relevant. And it makes it, in hearings I've sat on, in a process where everything did go through the chair, it does make it a little less intimidating, I think, for the students that are asking the questions. And there are definitely times that you have to say to yourself, with your professional training, with the knowledge of the case at hand, that there is a question that isn't appropriate. And specifically, I mean, that happens in 6.4 sometimes. I mean, it does happen. But there are things that you just wouldn't want asked. And if we don't have faith in the process and the people leading it to make sure that they're using their best judgment to figure that out, then that's a problem too, right? So I'm in favor of it going through the chair.
Risa?
Yeah, I think we're conflating two different issues here in the discussion. A chair can always find that a question that's being asked is not appropriate and not allow the question from anyone, whether it's the chair or from a panelist or the respondent or whoever. It's not relevant. It's asking for information that is not only not relevant, but perhaps, you know, is on the edge of relevancy, and it goes beyond the scope of what we're really trying to figure out, that it goes into, you know, we have other provisions later about like going into, you know, certain kind of private matters. That's always the ability, that's always the prerogative of the chair. That's why you have a chair, to rule on whether and decide whether certain questions should be asked at all. I think what we're talking about here, and we should remain focused on, is whether the parties should be able to ask questions. And, you know, at this point, it's written, so yes, the parties get to ask questions to the witnesses, but there are moments, there are certain situations where the chair can say, no, under these circumstances, only the chair and the panelists will ask questions. And so that's in those interpersonal cases where that additional discretion should be carried out by the chair, to say, no, the parties don't get to ask questions in this instance, only the panel gets to do it.
James, and then I'm going to ask for the committee to vote.
Sure, yeah. I'm in favor of indicating that the chair is allowed to ask questions at any time. I think that's fair. I think the solution of only allowing the chair to ask questions is disproportionate to the problem of the reasons that Risa said, that yeah, if the chair can rule on an objection, if a party asks a question and it's inappropriate, the chair can stop the question from being answered without this change. And then I think that the second reason it's probably not a good idea, is that I think we should also consider, you know, what inspires confidence in the process here. And I think from an objective standpoint, either from a student who's involved in the process or for students who are on the outside looking in at this code, it inspires probably more confidence in the outcomes, knowing that students themselves or the representatives are allowed to ask questions without going through some type of filter. I think we should be concerned with campus confidence in the process.
So I will, so we'll be moving into a vote. The question is, should all questions go through the chair? Yes, if you believe that to be so. No, if you don't think that should be, and it should say as written.
Just a question, Joe, are we going to have two different proposals on, because it seems like there are two proposals here. There are all cases go through chair, and then a second one that at least the chair can just inquire. So
that I believe the second one is already written onto that.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yep. Okay. It looks like for a vote of 1-7, it will be staying as written. We'll be moving down to now section 6.3. So making our way. There was a comment here.
This is one we can let go.
Okay, great, love it. And if I miss a comment or miss something that people do want to bring up as I go through this, like, please, like, just interrupt me. So the next set, I had a section of four questions that all kind of lie within 6.6. And so if some of these have changed, let me know. We can do some of that to do it. So the first one I have is, should the complainant be required to testify? Let me see if I can find. Yeah, so it's here. That was the first question I was able to pull out for this one. So people have initial sets of thoughts, or if that was changed, like, let me know. Yeah.
Just because I alluded to this earlier, this is a place where, you know, again, this is saying if an individual complainant doesn't testify, there are limits on whether or not a hearing panel can proceed to a decision. And just as the university has no authority to compel a respondent to testify, they also don't have the authority to compel a complainant to testify. And so there shouldn't be any additional hurdle that happens. The decision should just also be based on whether or not there's sufficient evidence to establish by the preponderance of the evidence whether or not there's a violation. And, you know, again, I trust, although I sometimes am not sure that this group collectively trusts, that, the JA's office would take into consideration whether or not a complainant is going to testify. If a complainant isn't going to testify, in some cases, you don't have any case to bring forward.
James.
Yeah, so my concern would be if the complainant files some type of report or writes something down, and that gets put into an exhibit packet, and then the hearing chair and the hearing members read the complaint on paper, then, you know, you're kind of getting the worst of both worlds as a respondent, because, you know, it's one thing if the complainant doesn't want to testify at all, none of that information comes out, because then I understand Barb's point that, well, then there's just not sufficient evidence. So why do we even need this? But if we're not going to have hearsay rules and we're going to allow written statements essentially saying the exact same thing, what they would have said testifying, to go to the panel, now you're getting that information to the panel and you still don't even have the opportunity to ask follow-up questions. So I think in the interest of fairness, it would have to be either or. It's either complainant has to testify for that information to get out, or if they don't testify, then the hearing panel can't hear it at all. Because otherwise, you know, you just have a situation where information is going to the panel and the student has no opportunity to question, you know, the veracity of that or the truthfulness of that. I think that the document is a good middle ground between what the current code has, which guarantees confrontation, and what is being proposed by Barbara, because it at least it throws a bone, I think, to the respondent, where it almost gets extra attention, and I think that that's important.
Gabrielle.
Yeah. So to just build on that a little bit, you know, the committee already voted to lower the standard of proof, which makes this provision even more significant to consider, because like Jimmy is saying, that if you can rely on a written statement that a complainant might have made, you know, not exactly knowing all of the information, just reporting the incident, and then the incident report becomes the basis to find someone responsible under preponderance of the evidence, I mean, that really could be enough, and there's no opportunity for the respondent to question any of the complainant's initial conclusions about, you know, either what happened or who they were. And I mean, anyone can submit an incident report. So, you know, I agree with what Jimmy's saying, that this is a balance, because it's not an absolute right to confront every person that, you know, makes an incident report. It's specifying those circumstances. And, you know, it's also not, it's saying when the complainant's interests outweigh. So there is some sort of balance here happening. It's not just an absolute right. And in context of the standard of proof, it is really important to consider that this protection is necessary for respondents.
If no one has anything else on this point, I'll ask for a vote. Yes being keep the language as it currently is, no being no, a complainant would not should not be required to testify. That's kind of how I'll phrase this question on this one. So yes, keep it as is. No, a complainant should not be required to testify.
Can I ask a quick question before we vote? Sorry.
Yeah, of course.
I raised my hand a little bit late. So we can't make a respondent testify, right? So why do we have to make a complainant testify? It seems, you know, I'm just confused by that. If we have no way to make a respondent show up and testify, why should we have to do that for the complainant?
Risa.
Well, I'm sure the other people can answer this as well, but it's the difference in treatment is the consistency between what the respondent is facing, which is a potential, you know, suspension or expulsion or some other kind of discipline, and the complainant who does not face that potential. So it's consistent with the notion that if you're the person who is facing the punitive results, then you have a particular interest in deciding whether to testify. In addition, for some respondents, they may be facing criminal prosecutions, and so if it turns out that we have a hearing and there's no criminal prosecution that's been resolved, then that person also may well face self-incrimination issues, where whatever they say in this hearing will be used by a prosecutor, you know, in a case, let's say it has to do with theft, something where there's an overlap, you know, between a criminal prosecution and the code. So it's in fairness, it's a fairness issue.
James and Barb.
Yeah, I think so. So one thing, at least my reading of the current language, is that this actually does not require a complainant to testify. Under this language, a complainant cannot testify, or doesn't, there's a situation where a complainant doesn't testify, yet the hearing panel can still proceed to a decision. So I think there are two hypotheticals where this could happen and where why this language is so important. So let's say hypothetical A, complainant, it was an assault. They're extremely distressed. They don't want to have to face the respondent in a hearing, right? In that case, that person may not have to testify. The hearing panel may say, you know what, we don't want their interests in testifying or not testifying outweigh the respondent's right because we don't want to put them through this traumatic experience. And this provision accounts for that. However, if let's say a police officer is the complainant or files the report or an RA, and it's maybe a run-of-the-mill, you know, alcohol in a room or something like that, then the hearing board may say, well, no, you know, what are your interests in not testifying? That you're not really emotionally, like, connected to the situation, so therefore we do want you to testify. So this is good for discretion because it doesn't require the complainant to testify. It allows a case-by-case situation. I think it takes into account a lot of the concerns that people have about putting the complainant in the spot where they do have to testify.
Okay. Thank you for all of that and a special guest appearance from Barb's cat.
Her name is Ruth Bader Button, so it's appropriate to the conversation here.
I'll move back into kind of the vote we had. Yes, if keeping the language as is, no, if kind of like this absolute kind of idea, no, absolutely, there should be none of that. And abstain, obviously, is still an option. Just message me. By 7-0-1, we'll keep the language as is for everyone. The next one, interrelated. So it goes to, should the hearing panel have the ability to order a witness to testify? That's kind of the question I pulled out from here. So Barb, you can correct me if I'm wrong with that.
Yes. So this I think we've built, my concern is you build in a process into these, into this set of procedures. That's redundant, but I don't know how you, I don't know how the chair has no authority to enforce that. The chair can't order anybody to testify. So it seemed to build in extra steps, potentially delay a process, and no way to enforce it. I suppose, yes, this conduct office could turn around and charge somebody with obstruction, but then you're charging with somebody with obstruction that, you end up penalizing the witness for something that's unrelated to the case at hand, and you end up delaying the case at hand, is my concern.
Okay. Risa.
Well, the language says if a witness with information of importance to the case refuses to testify, so it's already stating that they're relevant, and we do have those provisions in the other parts of the code that Barb pointed to in terms of, I can't remember the exact language, I'm not looking at it now, but requiring people to cooperate kind of thing, which is not always my favorite sort of code provisions, but we do have those.
I've actually heard some concern that our office has used those procedures more frequently than some in the community may think is appropriate.
Yeah, so, and I actually agree with that. But it may actually be appropriate here, where you have witnesses who really are important. And it does give the chair discretion based on the balance of equities for the witness. So there may well be a witness who says, here are the reasons I don't want to testify. And the chair can say, well, yeah, you're right. You don't have to testify. I mean, maybe you actually have somebody who may incriminate themselves, you know, if they testify and they're concerned about other proceedings or something like that.
Jen.
I would just say that I don't know how you would compel somebody to participate if they don't want to participate unless you're then charging them, like Barb said. And then what a gigantic circular process that is, because now you're charging people that don't want to come to one case. Now you're charging them with a different violation that they have to come to a different case. Some people just don't want to be involved. Even if they have information, they might not want to be involved. And if we can't like order them, I think order the witness to testify, like that just seems, we don't have any leverage for that. People come forward when they want to, not because they've been ordered to.
Bryce.
Yeah, I mean, I think in our minds, we obviously have some different senses of the cases where this would apply, but I'm just imagining that in hazing cases and other such cases, you know, the assembly of evidence is going to require having some people who might be uncomfortable testifying to actually do so. And we have that, I know, I don't remember the word we decided upon, but we have that obstruction clause in the code, and it really just seems like the chair needs the power to order and compel testimony, and the fact that we have it in the code makes that compulsion a real thing. And so I think that's going to be the way that some complex cases actually get dealt with. But I mean, I'm just speculating. So I mean, I think Jen's thinking about a different kind of case where, you know, witnesses may be reluctant to testify and they're not involved at all in what happened.
I can share. I served on, sorry, Joe, I went without you calling on me.
No, you're good.
I served on a recent hazing case, and the witness statements were included in the packet, but the organization was represented by the leadership. So those witnesses didn't have to come into the room and reshare what happened. We received a packet of information from their witness statements. And I thought that was okay. You know, I mean, I didn't need to have them sit in front of me to tell me what happened. I was passed information that was investigated by trained people to get the information that was relevant and turn it over to the panel. So that's where I was coming from on my thought.
Gabrielle.
So I think that based on what's written, that both Bryce and Jen's examples would fit under that, because like we've said, it's when the, I now don't have the information in front of me, but with information of importance to the case, right? So if there are these witness statements and there's no reason to have someone, a witness, come in and say the exact same thing again, then there would be no reason to use this. But if a crucial witness has not been interviewed, there's no formal statement of what they said, then, you know, it might trigger this. So it seems like both of those examples are consistent with this language.
Anything else on this? Seeing none, I'll ask for a vote on this question. So yes, if you want to maintain the language as currently written. No, if you believe that the hearing panel should not have the ability to order a witness to testify. The yes was, again, the yes is to maintain the language as currently written in that section, and the no is to say no, the hearing panel should not have that ability. And by a vote of 6-2, the language will be maintained. The next section I have is, and this could be split, if people want it to be split, if they feel like there's a difference. But the question I have is, should the investigative report be admissible evidence, and should the investigator be able to testify as a witness? And if you want that split of yes, only the investigative report, and no, not the testimony, we can do that depending on how people want to tackle this question. But I'll give people time to gather thoughts.
I'd like to understand why this language is proposed and why you would not admit an investigative report.
Risa.
Yeah, so first on your question, Joe, I think it's probably sensible to talk about the issues separately. You know, should the investigator be able to testify? And if so, what's the scope of the evidence that can come in through the investigator? I think that's appropriate, because I actually think that the investigator probably should be able to testify, but my major concern is on the investigative report being put in as admissible evidence. And that goes to Barb's question, because my concern is that this hearing, now we're at the hearing panel, you know, the full-blown hearing, should be based on direct knowledge that the witnesses have of the situation. Now, I know we're not using, you know, hearsay objections and things like that. You know, we're not using the strict rules of evidence, but I think that the reliability piece that we all agree on, relevance and reliability of evidence, reliability is increased by having people testify to what they know directly, as opposed to, well, you know, this is what this other person told me. And so, you know, basically related to what we're just saying, well, we don't really need to hear from this other person who has the direct knowledge. So I think that if an investigator testifies, that the investigator should not simply be able to say, well, here's my report, and that substitutes for what people actually have to say about their direct knowledge. That's my concern.
Okay, so I will split the question, and so we'll start with talking about the investigative record first, and then the investigator testimony second, and they might play off each other in discussion, but I'll do that. So Jen?
I would 100% be in favor of the investigative report being included. That document is so key to the panel's decision making. The panel is not the investigators of the case. There are trained investigators that we need to trust as an institution to do their job right, to pass over their investigative report to get a lot of the information from. Just like the case I just talked about, 99.9% of the information was in that investigative report. And if I didn't trust that report, then I would feel like I wasn't trusting my institution to have the right people in the right positions at the right time. And the investigative report is just key for admissibility, I would think.
James?
Yeah, I think the argument that it's, you know, really, really important to the panel's decision, this investigative report, is actually the best reason why it shouldn't be allowed in, is because it's not firsthand knowledge, or at least a lot of the information won't be firsthand knowledge. And I think it makes sense to have the investigative report come in if all of the witnesses whose accounts are in the report actually testify. Then I don't think that's a problem. But I think that's the concern, you know, it goes to what Reese was saying. We want to make sure that there's reliable information here, and just written down statements taken from an investigator, I don't think is the most reliable form of information, and certainly not more reliable than the person who wrote it down just coming in and talking to the panel members.
Jen?
I think a lot of times investigative reports involve transcription, and I think that you're getting firsthand accounts. I mean, the cases I sat on, I did have transcription and direct quotes from a plethora of people that were investigated. And I have to believe that the person that did that was taking the words verbatim. What is their stake in the game that they wouldn't do a good job or do the right job? It doesn't make any sense to me that they would falsely represent somebody because they're trained to do this. That's what they do. Aaron, is that okay?
Yeah, no, you can finish your thought, Jen. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I lean more towards trust, I think, in trusting the process and trusting the people that have been trained to do that work. So I would believe it. I would leave it in.
Risa?
Yeah, this isn't an issue, in my view, of trust. You know, it may be that the investigator wrote down exactly what the investigator heard, but the reason for having a hearing is because a hearing is different from an investigation. An investigation is to decide whether to charge a violation of the code. The hearing is for the panel, and particularly we're talking about this panel, which is not on paper. It's based on witnesses, primarily. It's different to be hearing evidence from the people with knowledge as opposed to reading somebody's report or hearing them report on what they heard. It's not an issue of is the investigator a good person, a bad person, a truthful person. I mean, I would hope that they're, you know, everybody who's testifying is truthful. It's not that issue, and I hope we don't turn it into that. I think it's a question of what's the most reliable way when you have people facing potential severe consequences, something like, you know, expulsion at the worst end for that respondent, what is the best way to get evidence so that the hearing panel can observe the witnesses, decide who's credible, fill in the information that perhaps wasn't brought out through the investigative report? I mean, this is what hearings do. Hearings bring out information. And so I think that our reliance in these kinds of hearings needs to be on the witnesses, not on some prior statement that was made in a report.
I'm going to jump in real quick, and it might not be, you know, the best chairing kind of duties. I feel extremely strongly on this point, and the reason I originally linked the two in my head was because I personally believe that if the report is there, then, and there's testimony from the investigator, there can be that kind of ability for the panel to like read it and interrogate, and if like academically interrogate the findings of that investigator to really understand more. And that's why I personally linked them in my head, but I offered to the committee to split it because I understand that I chair some, my personal opinion isn't always the one that's the important part. So I personally, again, and I don't want to seem like I'm doing a bad job chairing by putting my personal opinion out there, I personally support both the report and testimony from the investigator being part of the evidence, with the understanding that if there is the report present, the investigator must have that testimony to kind of be able to include that. And this comes from my experience in serving on the Greek Judicial Reform Group. And this was something that was extremely important to every stakeholder in that room. And there was a lot of support for it there. And that's why I feel very strongly on it. But I understand that everyone's views may differ on that. So, James.
Yeah. So I think that's a good point that, the investigator, if the report comes in, I think it does make sense for the investigator to testify, but here's the big issue is that the investigator can't answer the types of questions that the respondent would want to ask the people whose statements are in that report. So if you have someone say, you know, I think I saw, you know, Jones, you know, hit this guy. You know, a question that you might want to ask, well, how far were you? How dark was it? The investigator can't answer those questions. The investigator can only point to the statement they have, which is, well, it looked like Jones did it. So the disconnect here is that the investigator, not that they're not trustworthy, but they simply can't answer those types of questions because the person who actually made the statement of what they saw isn't actually there to give testimony.
Risa.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Kind of following up on Joe's comments and then James's comments, that if the report comes in, then the investigator must testify. Because there are holes in reports. People are doing what they can do in a report, and there are holes and there are things people don't know, and you can establish that by the respondent asking questions about that, the panel asking questions about that. You know, it just shows what's in it and what isn't in it, and also I think clarifies where you really have disagreements and you need the witnesses, which is why it's so important to be able to have all of those witnesses in that who are named in that report testify. So so if the report comes in, I think that the investigator must testify. If the investigator testifies without the report, then my view is that the investigator is basically describing this is what I did to investigate, as opposed to some kind of description of here's what everybody said.
Yeah, Barb.
So I appreciate, I'll just say, you know, we had raised this question. I think I would support the positions that Jen and Joe have articulated. And I would just add, in addition to this, you know, these proceedings have to be fair to both parties. And it can't be efficiency that dictates anything. But I do think it's important to consider if this institution is gonna invest the resources and have trained investigators to do this process, one of the repercussions if you don't allow an investigative report to come in is all of the who are we talking about here? We're talking about students at this institution. And generally they are the ones who are the witnesses in these proceedings. It's students, and that will be the case in this student conduct process in particular. So we're talking about a process where, you know, we have this articulation that they're supposed to be cooperate. So when the investigator comes around, they should cooperate. They should take time away from, you know, their studies, their extracurriculars, and they participate in this investigative process. And then when the hearing comes, they have to come and testify all over again. This is a place, I really do appreciate that people are attentive to the rights of respondents in this process, but I really urge the committee to remember that this is a community process. This is about community standards of behavior. Students mess up sometimes, they do. And when they do, it has an impact on other people. And I just think it's really important to think about how we handle these hearings in a way that is fair to the respondent, yes, but is also fair to the other people in the community who are affected when students do engage in inappropriate conduct. I have seen it at another institution where the very first witness the investigative report gets distributed with the packet of materials. The very first witness in every single case is the investigator. And everybody, both parties, the chair, the panel, everybody can ask questions of that investigator. And if the investigator did a lousy job and didn't, you can't ask questions of the, you may still ask questions. Some of those witnesses may still come and testify. But you can certainly challenge the credibility of that investigative report if the person, you know, hasn't asked the questions that might have been asked. You know, I think it's fair for a panel to say in that case, on that point, well, I don't feel like I have the evidence that I need to, you know, to support a finding of responsibility here because there were questions that didn't get asked. So I'm a strong proponent of the investigative report absolutely should come in, and the investigator absolutely should be required to be a witness.
Risa.
Yeah, I mean, it feels to me like we're moving towards something that I think can work, which is kind of a three-prong piece. One is that where the investigative report is admitted as evidence, then the investigator must be available to be questioned on it as a witness, and that any party has the right to call any witness who is identified in that investigative report to testify. Now, that may be implicit in the fact that everybody gets to call witnesses under the way that this is written, but I think that given the heavy reliance that people can make on an investigative report as a substitute, that it should be explicitly stated that the parties have the right to call any of the witnesses identified in the investigative report or to see documents, you know. Yeah,
sorry, Risa. Bryce.
Yeah, so I'm just a little bit worried about the case where the investigative report is the only evidence, I mean, or the testimony of the investigator. I think if we're going to rely on a preponderance of the evidence standard, then unfortunately we need to be a little bit more stringent about what counts as evidence. So I agree with Risa that that we need to make sure that we can have witnesses come in and testify. And so I'm more comfortable at this point with a standard that requires that direct testimony rather than just the investigative report.
So what I'm going to do to basically pose this question, it's going to just change this section to say, if the investigative record / report is admitted and the investigator must testify, being part one, the investigator may testify without the report as a witness, as number two, and then three, if the investigative report is admitted, parties have the right to call anyone as a witness who is named in that report. So that's how I would kind of chunk it out into three different things as three options that people have to give it. And I think that's the one. So yeah, Risa, just isn't, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that if the investigator testifies without the report, I'm assuming that most of the time the report will come in with them, but if they do, if the investigator testifies without the report, that any individuals identified in the investigator's testimony can be called as witnesses. Yeah.
So I will ask a vote on that, on my three-prong amendment, essentially, to this bullet. Yes, if you support that amendment, and no, if you don't.
Can you say it one more time?
Yep. So the first prong is, if the report is admitted as evidence, the investigator must testify. Second prong being, the investigator may testify without the report, and if anyone is named in that testimony, they may be called as a witness. And the third part is, if the investigative report is admitted as evidence, parties may have the right to call anyone named in that report as a witness. So that's kind of the three prongs. So 7-0, we will, sorry, I'm not good at double check. Yep, 7-0, we will be doing that. That will be a change made. The next one I have is a smaller one. There's a mention of a verbatim record. There's a suggestion that all hearings shall be recorded except deliberations, and if audio recording is an acceptable version of verbatim recording. So I don't know if that necessarily needs discussion on it, unless people want clarification, but I'm going to ask for a quick vote on that, if no one has anything. So yeah, quick vote. So again, that will be 7-1. So we'll clarify that in there. The next one I have is section 6-7. Should there be written closing statements? There were some changes made to this. So if my question is no, is moved, just let me know on that option as I read it as well. It seems like with the changes that Risa suggested, there might be, it might not be as big of a concern.
Can I just say something, Joe, about that? I mean, what I was trying to do in some of these suggested edits was to respond to some comments about, can we make this a little shorter, a little simpler. Mm-hmm. So both written and oral and written closing statements are still in there.
Okay.
It's just shorter.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone on this?
Just quickly, I would encourage people, how helpful are the written closing statements for people to have to go back and prepare, but it's not one that in the scheme of things I would push for, but I do think it adds to the formality, takes time, creates added costs for students who have lawyers who are participating, and all of that seems in experiences that I've had, not here recently but elsewhere, not to add a lot of value, that the oral arguments at the end have been sufficient.
Bryce.
Yeah, so I guess Barb's point confuses me a little bit. Maybe I'm just not understanding this. I mean, we're talking about students who are about to be possibly expelled from the university. I think we need written closing statements and quite a bit of formality in those cases. They're a very small number of cases, right?
Mm-hmm. So kind of seeing no other voices on. Oh. Gabrielle.
This was just a clarifying point. Because I think that these aren't necessarily that you have to write the statement. So like if it's not sufficiently complicated where you would just give an oral closing, I mean this isn't at all required of the parties.
Okay. Kind of seeing nothing else. I will ask for a vote from the committee. Yes, if you do believe that there should be written closing statements, so basically as written, and no, if you believe that there shouldn't be an option. So 6-1 on that one. We'll be moving down into, unless there's something. No, that was this companion document. Let's see here. The next 6.9, one is in section
6.9. We'll defer if people don't want that. And also 7.3. People feel strongly about that. We're happy to defer.
Okay. 6-9 was just the allowing of dissenting opinions. Currently those are allowed. And 7-3 was a more stringent standards for appeals. If people feel strongly on either of those two things, currently it's slated that dissenting opinions are allowed and the appeals are pretty much laid out, broadly. So in 5 different points. But if people don't feel strongly, I'll move down to you, which is also in section 7.3. And that is essentially, should the complainant, respondent, and OSCCS have the same right to appeal, or should it be maintained how it currently is? It's in writing. So I will let people take it away on that one. Yeah, Barb.
So I just want to make one observation, and I think it's a point, but those of you who have been in the code more detailed recently than I have been, this may not be the case, but I guess whatever we do here, and I'm not going to say anything more about what we should do, but I think the code currently distinguishes between sanctions and remedies. And this redraft groups those together and refers to sanctions and remedies. And so if there's a decision about who can appeal what that distinguishes between sanctions and remedies, you need to make sure that's consistent with what you've done with the language elsewhere. I think that Risa and Gabrielle might know what I'm saying there, and probably the rest of you do too.
Yeah, if I could, I think that, which I can't actually remember for sure, but I think this stemmed from discussions with Risa about the like ensuring that it's clear that the JA's office is the one who's actually like bringing the complaint. It's not the complainant at all. So I think that that is maybe why the language got lumped in together for remedies and sanctions, but I don't actually remember for certain.
Yep, Risa.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm also just looking at the current code. And it does currently say in the code, any complainant other than the university community, la, 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 shall have the right to appeal a hearing panel decision to the review panel if remedies were sought or if other laws or regulations require allowing such appeal. And so it's a little unclear as is currently stated. So I guess it would be, I'm glad that Barb raised this because I do think there's, you know, ambiguity here. And so if the language of remedies is used, what, I guess the factual question is, what does that cover? Because we use sanctions or remedies. And so remedies would be something like restitution, I guess. As opposed to a sanction, which would be what the JA's office might be appealing.
So it might be one that you just need to put a marker in. It feels like it's one pretty clearly that you can't, I don't know whether this group can deal with it right this moment or during this call. But.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. So then I will put kind of a note next to this one and just say, just offer, just give like a little thing in public comment, like saying like the committee is still considering, you know, remedies/sanctions in terms of appeals and stuff like that and request feedback broadly. So I will move on. Section 7.4. It was kind of, yeah. So the question was, should the grounds for appeal be the same for the administrative panel and hearing panel? And then also in 7.4, should the complainant and respondent have the same right to appeal? I will take W also as the same kind of issue we had with you, and I'll just keep that to public comment. But broadly, we're talking about V, which is grounds of appeal for administrative panel and hearing panel.
Yeah, Risa.
Well, my understanding of this and my thinking on this is that the differences in the grounds for appeal reflects the differences in why we're having two different kinds of hearings, and that the appellate grounds for the administrative panel would be narrower than the appellate grounds for the full hearing panel. So that would be my understanding of why we're doing that, or why it's proposed anyway.
Okay. If there's nothing more on this, I'll ask for a vote. Yes being they should be the same, and no being that they shouldn't be the same, so it's as written. So no is as written, yes being combine the two. So that is 2-5 in favor of them staying different. So we'll move on to X, which is section 7.5. This was a concern on length. I didn't necessarily know how to chunk this down into like potential timelines. It would just seem that there was a desire to make this process a bit shorter. Barb, if you want to elaborate more on this one for me.
Yeah, I don't know whether there, so I think there are places, I'm just going to leave the conversation to you all in terms of what you think the process, how long the process ought to be. Certainly, again, I understand that these are serious issues that are at stake here. This is a review process for student conduct that could end up taking something like 7 to 8 weeks, if you count business days, after a decision is reached. So that's again, there is a lot at stake for everybody, not just the student who's accused, but the students who might have been affected. And it seems like that's a long way to wait. And every time we change 3 days to 5 days, it makes the process, it sounds like it's only 2 days, but especially if you're talking about business days or calendar days, and it might be good to decide and just use one thing, business days or calendar days throughout, but it's just a general concern about how long this process is, as it's described, and that it's, again, from my perspective, if the goal here is to have a student-centered campus code of conduct that is less formalistic, I think this is one more place where I feel that it doesn't necessarily serve the goal of having a less legalistic, more student development-centered process.
Gabrielle.
So I'm actually a little confused. So just looking for some clarity here. So I agree that sounds like a crazy amount of time, 34 business days and 40 business days. So is that including the amount of time that it takes the decision to be rendered, or is that just the parties submitting statements? Because I think the thing that I was thinking about with the times, honestly, was that when you do this with business days, so long as you have like 5 business days, it almost always gives students a weekend, which I think is just really important, being mindful of like academic concerns. So yeah, I guess I'm just trying to figure out where the numbers are coming from.
So I just added up the numbers that are they're the outside numbers, that somebody has 5 days, then there's 10 days, then there's 10 days, then I think there was 10 days to submit a written response. So, somebody can check my math, but I tried to add up the different time segments that were in each appeal process that was described, and it seems like a lot.
Risa.
Well, I mean, you know, if there are places where this can be shaved down, then, you know, I think we should look at that to see if it can be shaved down. I mean, like in terms of how much time the appeals panel has to, you know, write, to decide, you know. I don't know how much time they have right now. I don't remember. Is 20 business days too much, you know? I think probably for the hearing panel, one of the questions is just, you know, getting everybody together to talk. And so you build in a little bit of extra time. But there might be ways to shave off, you know, for example, when the review panel, it says, provides a copy of the appeal statement to the other party. You know, maybe they don't need 10 business days, right? Maybe that could be shaved down. So, I mean, I think that there are probably places where, you know, you could shave it down for a few days, but it seems to me that it's just a few days here and there.
Yeah, I think it is a more fundamental question of when you create a process with this level of formality to it and you start going down that path, then I agree, it gets hard to pull it back and say, well, if you're gonna, if you're going to give this much to this person needs that much, the panel needs to meet. I'm sorry for the cat. It's just an observation I encourage the committee to think about as you decide what you think your final product should be.
Yes, Risa.
Well, it's just to follow up on that. I mean, I think that that Barb is correct in pointing out the underlying fundamental question is, you know, should there be an appeals process that has the ability of somebody to, you know, an appellant to, or more than one appellant, I guess, to submit something in writing, and then to have the other side be able to submit something in writing in response, and then have an appeals panel decide based on the record, you know, that's recorded and the decision from the lower body and make a decision. I mean, that is not a complicated process. Like, what are your appellate points? What are your responses? And then the appeals panel decides. I don't see that as complicated, but I do see it as fundamentally fair. And the timing, you know, maybe can be played with a little bit, but I think that the underlying back and forth and then a decision makes perfect sense.
I don't mean to suggest at all that there shouldn't be an appeal period with both parties being able to raise their issues. I'm not suggesting that at all.
Yeah, Bryce. You're muted.
Sorry. Based on what we decided earlier, though, for the most part, this would be not the, or I'm guessing, and maybe someone else can correct me if I'm wrong, but for the most part, this will be in practice for the hearing panel. Is that right? Because the administrative panels, you have to, it seems like we set pretty strict, I mean, we just voted on it and it was a close vote. So, you know, it seems like we could have gone one way or the other, but by setting the administrative panel appeal to be fairly stringent, or in other words, it's not allowed most of the time, then most cases aren't even going to get to this. And so it's really only very serious cases that then would have this very long drawn out appeal.
Yeah. We don't have to have a complete timeline of this. I mean, there can just be a general sense that the committee wants this to be shorter and ask the public to weigh in on what they feel is appropriate with an amount, a number, and we can come back to this point if that's the vote that people want to take. But my general sentiment from what it just feels like everyone at the committee is that this process can be shaved a little bit shorter. So unless people have, yeah, okay. So I will ask for a vote on, does the committee believe there should be a shorter timeline for appeal? Yes, if you do believe so, no, if you don't. And we'll return back to specific numbers of days later after public comment.
But we're basically leaving this in place, is that it? I mean, the...
Yeah, there'll be a... Yeah.
So, Joe, you're leaving it in place with a note that says we want it to be shorter.
Yeah, this it will be in public comment, just like in kind of in brackets. It'll be like, the CJC believes that this process can be shorter, but has yet to come up with exact numbers of days for each part of the appeals process, and saying we welcome your feedback on the number of days that you find appropriate, understanding that this is the viewpoint of the committee. So the final vote on that is 6-0. The committee believes that this process should be a bit shorter. My next one is, and this question might actually not be a question anymore. Yeah, Barb.
It's not. That's fine.
Yeah.
That actually probably should not have been in there. That was actually my bad that we are fine with appeals on the record.
Okay. And the other one I have is, the next one is down in 8.3, and this might have been answered by our earlier discussion on this topic. It is, what circumstances would prior findings of responsibility not be admissible? Let me see if I can. Here you go. So there's this. So just as a refresher, we kind of made the decision that only Cornell conduct be noted in prior, for like only prior Cornell conduct be noted, not overall conduct. So that's kind of just a harken back.
I guess what I was just trying to figure out here is, we've said elsewhere the language is that prior findings of Cornell misconduct will be admissible, shall be submitted, shall be provided. But here it says that they're regularly admissible, which sounds like sometimes they might not be.
Yeah, Risa. Oh, actually, sorry, Gabrielle, then Risa.
That's okay, Risa. Risa can go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I guess I was just going to say, to me, this seems like maybe an oversight, because I agree, I see what you're saying, that this seems inconsistent with the previous section. But I also agree with Risa's point here, so that makes me question the previous section, but.
Risa.
Yeah, I was looking for the language we had before, because certainly we want consistency, and I wanted to see what we actually did say before about it in terms of when those can be used. Can we do that? Because I think we can deal with it then.
Yeah, let me go. It's in section 4.2. Sorry for scrolling.
I think it's 4.2 and 5.6 are the other places.
4.2, so respondent's previous a respondent's previous disciplinary record at Cornell University and any other criminal convictions. So I can copy and paste that down.
The top part says, in recommending sanctions and remedies, the OSCCS will consider.
Right, so that's consistent with the provision we're looking at, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. It would say, the section we're looking at in 8.3 seems to carve out some times when the committee wouldn't look at prior conduct history.
You mean for sanctions?
In considering sanctions, correct. Okay. Never an issue at the, responsibility phase, but I don't know of any other system that doesn't consider prior findings of misconduct at the sanction stage.
Okay, fair enough. What section are we on now for the sanction stage?
8.3.
8.3, okay.
So just to strike the word regularly.
Okay.
Let me see here. Oh, yeah, that's fine with me.
Okay. We can strike regularly from the record. So just delete that. There we go. The next one I have is in section 8.5. This one was, is it necessary to include the vice president of student campus life or let the body decide on the conflict of interest? And this kind of applies to the last one we have. Should a conflict of decision be made up to individuals or up to the body? But in two different processes. Yeah, Barb.
Well, I think that, so I asked the question here. It seems the most efficient way is to have the body itself, which is a process I'm familiar with that exists in other types of documents, that if there's a conflict of interest, it's the body itself minus the person who might potentially be conflicted who would answer the question of whether or not there's a conflict. It seems somewhat cumbersome to get the VP for student campus life involved. But again, that seems like a place where we could make it less complicated by letting the board or the committee decide. But if you all feel strongly, I don't have dog in that fight, whatever I'm trying to say at this point.
Hey, Gabrielle.
I mean, I like that, specifying that the rest of the members of the panel or the chair. I guess the only time I see a potential issue, just thinking about this as I'm talking, is where the chair is the one with the conflict. I guess maybe the panelists could review that. But I mean, to my knowledge, the current the existing campus code of conduct does not even have a sort of consideration for conflicts of interest. So having the body itself consider those, I think would be fine.
Bryce.
So are we considering have it just say notify the panelists instead of notify the chair? And in terms of whether it's the VPSCL, it just seems like having that off, it just seems like that's just necessary to specify who's going to be, who the respondent should notify. They may not know everyone on the committee. And so it just seems like we need a single point of entry into the process, and that it should be that office if it's under that office. Oh, oops, sorry. Lower hand.
So kind of what I'm hearing from everyone is that there's a conflict of interest as a notification to the vice president of student campus life. And after that notification, the panel gets to decide on that conflict of interest. The VPSCL would then notify all the panelists and then say, can you make a decision on this for both of them that we have there in conflicts of interest? So I'll ask for a vote on that change. So again, it's the individual who has a conflict of interest notifies the vice president of student campus life, and then the vice president of student campus life will notify the rest, the panel or whoever, will notify the panel and they'll make that decision. And so, yes, if you support, yeah, Bryce.
Sorry to do this again. Can others also notify the VSPCL? I mean,
yeah, it seems like if a respondent, I would assume that they're, you know, if a panelist believes that they have a personal conflict of interest, they can just, you know, notify VPSCL and ask the panel to vote to recuse themselves. We could add that as well if that's a concern for people.
I think that should be explicit. I mean, we don't want to be so procedural that we cut off some obvious avenues.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then I'll make that note that anyone in the process can notify VPSCL that they believe a panelist might have a conflict of interest. Then VPSCL notifies the panelists. Everyone. So, yes, if you support that amendment. No, if you don't, and if you're confused, just let me know.
I'm a little confused about what we're doing here. I'm sorry to insert yet another thing. I mean, the idea that anybody in the whole world can just say, I think there are conflicts of interest, would seem a little excessive to me. It seems that it's really more certainly the panelists should state whether they have a conflict. The parties should be able to say, we think there's a conflict, but to open it up, like the whole world can just enter into this, seems really excessive.
Yeah, I that's kind of how I meant of anyone. Okay. Anyone being involved in the process. Yes, sorry about that. Yeah. So yes, if you support that change, and no, if you don't, and that change will be consistent for kind of administrative panel, hearing panel, and appeal panel. All right. Looks like that one is 6-0 in favor of that change, which concludes our blockbuster agenda of votes. So kind of how I will operate now. So since, I mean, I'm accepting, you know, any kind of language changes that weren't brought up as, you know, things that I will just mark as resolved and implement them. And then I will go through and, does someone have her hand up? Jen? Yeah, Jen, sorry.
Jen, you're on mute.
Oh. I just have one quick thing. Sorry about that. I know you're going to go through the document and clean it up and let us read it before we go to comment, right? But I was reviewing it last night, and if you go back up to 6.9, and then so in here, and Risa, maybe you didn't intend to, but it looks like yesterday you inserted a clear and convincing evidence standard. So, Joe, were you going through and correcting all of that based on what we've already determined as the decision of the committee?
Yeah, I will.
Okay, because it's here and then it's in another spot as well.
Yep, I have made note of that for myself. As I go through and I clean up everything, I'll be implementing changes that we've made over the past couple of meetings inside of the procedures. I will also be highlighting sections in which there was significant disagreement and trying my best to kind of capture what the committee was thinking, those who are in the majority, those who are also in the minority. And I will be sharing the clean document with you all. And I also will be sharing the kind of the comments from majority and minority in specific sections that are highlighted. So I will be doing that for everyone as we go through it. I believe I can make a copy of this Google Doc and then keep all those original comments and then make a copy and have that be the clean one so we can still have, you know, a continuous set of where comments were made, and so I'm not deleting comments at all. So I will be doing that as soon as I possibly can. And sending that back out for everyone to make final revisions, to get clarifications, for me to do better on any potential explanatory factors. And my goal is to have that up either Monday or early Tuesday at the latest, with the intention that public comment will go to May 1. Our next Friday meeting, we'll start to look at comments on the substantive first part of the code and, you know, go back, and there are some things that we have to add definitions for and things like that. And we can keep doing it like that. So I think that's kind of the game plan on my end. I see Gabrielle and Jen have questions, so go for it.
I just have a quick, oh.
No, I was going to say you go first.
I just have a quick logistical question. So looking at the way that the comments are uploaded for the violation section, it's like the links and stuff.
Yeah.
So on the portions where either you're going to like specify votes or say like we're seeking, like this is still up. Like, I guess just mm-hmm. what is that going to look like with the links?
It would probably be, you know, in that link of the section, there will be link and then it would say section with specific request from CJC. So it's noted that the CJC is specifically requesting something there. And so when it takes you to the section, it will say the section language, but in bracketed text, the committee requests, here's what the committee believes and requests specific feedback around this. So I'll work with the office to make sure that that is as noted as best as possible and as clear as possible. And if when it comes up, if people say, oh, it should be more clear, we can make decisions as quick, you know, in real time too. So I will make sure that that's there. Jen.
I just wanted to add, I know that the burden of proof discussion was close. I think the vote was really close.
Yeah.
But so it's been playing around in my head, and I went back to my background in Title IX and reviewed some documents. So in order for Title IX to have a burden of proof of preponderance of evidence, which is what it is, you have to also have preponderance of evidence in your code. And that's stated in the guidelines. So it's almost like we don't have an option. And I'm happy to send this document to everybody to understand it. It's from the Department of Ed. But what it says is that that we can apply either preponderance of evidence or clear and convincing, but we can only use preponderance of evidence for Title IX if we use it for the code. And so I can't imagine a Title IX office anywhere that's going to want to use clear and convincing for a sexual assault case. So I think that our hands are a bit tied legalistically, and I'm happy to send this to anybody, but I just didn't want to set us up for public comment and people vote one way or the other, and then really we have to go back to what the guidelines say anyway.
Yeah, Risa?
Yeah, I mean, the Title IX stuff is very much in flux right now, because the current Department of Education has proposed changes and we don't really know exactly mm-hmm. what they're going to do. It's true that in the proposal it says that if you can choose either, in the proposed regs you can choose either preponderance or clear and convincing, but it should be consistent across the board. But I don't think that we should make a decision on what we think is the best or the most desirable practice in this code based on thinking, well, we probably can't do it anyway. I mean, I certainly yeah. argued for clear and convincing for 6.4 as well.
Yeah, and that was my guidance from University Council when having this conversation of standard of proof, burden of proof, is that University Council said that make the decision that you make in regards to the committee, and any potential regulation, University Council will help sort that out when needed, and conversations that would have to happen will happen facilitated through University Council with the relevant stakeholders. So I was given guidance just to say, recommend what the committee wants to recommend, do your majority minority report when you feel like it's necessary. So that's kind of how I'm doing it on my end and kind of the guidance that I was given in that regard. But Jenna, you're welcome to circulate the documents to the committee. And if anyone else has relevant documentation on standard of proof from Department of Ed, please circulate that through the committee just so everyone is aware of everything. So, but that's all for me. I mean, I can't tell you how grateful I am for everyone and all of their work that they do in this process, because it's obviously it's a lot of work and it's just true dedication from each and every one of you. And I can't be more grateful to have a great committee for this process, because it's just to do this in one semester is so insane in a sense. And I wish we had a longer time to do this to get the great discussions that we always do. I mean, I learn so much from this committee and I'm sure everyone else does. So, I mean, from the bottom of my heart, thank you. We're not done yet, but we're very close to it. So if you do have questions and concerns that come up throughout this period of time, please email me and I'll let you know when the UA has things going on. I'm going to be preparing kind of short one-pagers for the UA on major issues that we've tackled that was requested from me by the exec committee, and I will circulate those with the committee that you all can take a look at and, you know, say, oh, maybe we should add that. So anything that I'm sending to the UA, I just want to be completely transparent and share that with you all so that you have your eyes on it as well. And when the votes start happening at the UA, I'll be sure to share the Zoom link with everyone if they want to sit in on those meetings as well. So, yep, Risa.
So
Sorry, but you may have already told us this in terms of the timeline for the UA. When would you anticipate that the big discussion and vote happening?
So we have three more meetings left, and they happen on April 28th. April 28th is kind of just my introductory stuff of being like, here's everything we've kind of worked on. Generally, we're still in the public comment phase, so we still have a meeting before that. But it's mostly going to be on the substantive part that they've seen for a while and, you know, kind of stuff that we would have talked about. So that will be April 28th. There'll be a May 5 one, which is a pretty deep dive on violations and procedures. So that's a very intensive conversation. And then there is the final vote on all the documents on May 12th, and if we need it. So May 12th is the last meeting of the UA for this vote on everything, and then all of that documentation will be sent to the president. And kind of in that all, the final set of materials is going to be the substantive code, the procedural code, and then kind of an executive summary slash report from myself talking about everything we do. So Martha kind of has all of that background information as well for her. So that's what I'm planning on finally sending, but I'll have tons of other materials to give to all of you throughout the process. Okay. And I will share the Zoom links for each of those.
Yeah, yeah. And what goes to the UA and Martha would also include this, the third document, right, about the freedom of speech issue.
Yeah. Yep. So there is all that. So again, I greatly appreciate each and every one of you for sitting on your Saturday from 11 to 2:30. And I greatly appreciate the help from the Office of Assembly. So, you know, get rest, try not to think about the code for the next couple day or two, because I guarantee you on Monday you'll have something in your inbox from me. So thank you so much, everyone, and have a great rest of your weekend.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.